this computer, make sure it says recording. And we're going to go ahead and get started. So hello, everybody, and welcome to our post-shine training on advanced methylation topics. So advanced topics in nutrigenomics and methylation. And I know at Shine, we did do a very brief, like 15-minute like blast through on a lot of the methylation and nutrigenomics and the relationship to food. And I just thought it would be more fun to do this deep dive to really help you to see. In our, on our membership site, on our NEPT site, and also on our ERC, which is our coaching for our clients, we actually have probably close to 30 hours of recordings on this, including cases where I'm just going through and interpreting people's genetics. And it's a thing that, don't be hard on yourself if you don't get it right away. Don't be hard on yourself if you're going, whoa, there's a lot here and I'm not sure, and slow down. I'm going to go at a good pace. I'm not going to fast path it through and do the super fast movement, but I am going to go at a steady pace. You will have the recording of this. You've already been given the slides. There's like 150 or so slides that you've already been given. If you haven't been exposed to methylation and nutrigenomics very much, some of the stuff on those slides might sound like gobbledygook, might sound like it's a foreign language. But if you have, then great. You know, you some of it sounds familiar, and we're going to go deeper. We'll start with the basics. We'll start with a review, and then we'll move on. So without further ado, I'm going to share my slides. I'm going to ask that all of you keep your videos shut down. Don't show your video during the presentation. That way we'll get a really good recording. We won't have a bunch of, you know, videos and all. I did put you muted so that anybody comes in, you'll stay muted, and I appreciate if you don't unmute yourself until we get to questions, okay? And like I said before, this will be recorded, and you'll have access to the recording. So I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. And you should be seeing my screen now. All right. Whoops. I didn't want to make it big. I wanted to make it smaller so I can move it, so I could still see the chat. All right. So welcome, everybody, to our advanced topics in nutrigenomics and methylation. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I'm excited to be able to present this information to you because it's information that can give you an edge when you're working with people. Like an edge, by edge, I mean help you to see things and reasons for things being the way they are. And also, what I'm going to really share with you, my excitement about nutrigenomics and looking at people's genes and helping them to understand what it means, is that it gives me motivational tool. What I mean by that is when people see in print, it says, oh, your body has this particular alteration. I don't like to call them mutations. We'll get to that in a moment. That says you don't handle heterocyclic amines very well, which means, you know, exhaust fumes, charbroiled meats, etc. That has more motivational impact on a person when we're getting them to try to change their habits than it is for me to say, well, the studies say and this and that. They are seeing it in themselves and going, whoops, okay, I've got to deal with this. So there's a lot of that, and I'll share with you as we go along where I use some of these motivational tools and tips as we go through. So before we get too far in, I just want to make sure you understand that everything that I'm presenting is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional, and it's certainly not medical advice. And I advise you, when you're talking to people and when you're looking at their labs or looking at their genetics with them, that you're doing it from a place not of replacing their medical care, but from a place of helping them to understand how their body's working, what imbalances there are, and how they can support that and bringing it back to balance. I will say that if somebody's on medication, you're not going to say, don't take that medication. And we'll look at some of the genetics that we're going to look at. We'll give you an idea of how well somebody handles and metabolizes drugs. But under no circumstances should you say to somebody, oh, you should stop taking that drug because your body's not handling it. What you could say instead is, hey, according to your genes, you may have a slowed down capacity to detoxify from this particular medication. So I suggest that you have a conversation with your doctor to see if there's a way to either get off of it or replace it with something else. So that's how we're going to use this information. And from Shine, we focused a lot on the whole concept of food is medicine. And we know Hippocrates said that a long, long time ago, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. And with the understanding of nutrigenomics, what's going on in the person's body genetically, we can help to really fine tune that food so that it truly indeed becomes the medicine for that individual. Certain people are going to process certain foods better than other foods and actually find harmful some of the foods that someone else might find very good. We're going to look at some of those genetics. And I love the ancient Ayurvedic proverb, when the food is correct, medicine is of no need. When the food is incorrect, medicine is of no use. Is that true in 100% of the situations? No, there's always, you know, some exceptions to the rule. But in general, if you've got somebody and you can really teach them how to care for their frame, how to care for their body in a way that supports and nourishes it and restores balance, they don't need medicine. And if they take medicine, it's not going to do them any good. And if they're eating all the wrong stuff, medicine is really not going to help or cure them. All right. So I'm going to, as if people come in and they get their video going, I'm going to get rid of your videos. So I don't want any videos showing so that we get a good, good presentation. In fact, I might turn mine off as well. I might do that. Mute my video. No, not my audio. Well, I don't look good to go away. Hide myself. There we go. All right. So Hippocrates said, we're going to move on from there and we're going to apply this to the study of nutrigenomics. So this is my agenda for the evening. Okay. It's the afternoon now and it will probably go into the evening. And so I wanted to cover these 7 or 8 principles. First of all, I want to make sure we're all on the same page. So I'm going to start with foundational principles and definitions of all these terms, methylation, nutrigenomics, SNPs, etc. We're going to look at methylation. We're going to go into quite a bit of detail about methylation. What does that really mean and what does that have to do with your health or the health of the clients that you're working with? How do genetics support food choices and how should you choose your food based on genetics? So we'll have all the food and nutrient related genes. And then what about genetics related to blood sugar balance? Genetics related to hormone balance, genetics related to digestion, genetics related to detoxification, and then testing reports and action plans. So we're going to tie it all together. So I might be showing you or talking to you about these genes and you're going like, how do I find out what these are? Rest assured that whole last section is how are you going to actually find out what these genetics are and do some reports to analyze. So genetics 101, you might have learned this in high school and middle school, but 99.9, that's almost 100%, right, of our genes are in the nucleus of the cell. The rest of them are in the mitochondria, okay? The 0.1% is in the mitochondria. And the genes are in every cell of the body. The DNA is that helical strand that you're seeing depicted there. It's made of sugar, phosphate, and what's called nucleotide bases. And there's 4 of them, adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine. Okay. And then in the RNA, which we're not going to talk about at all today, there's also one called uracil and that replaces the thymine. So let's look at what is this DNA? Well, what does it do? It's actually 6 feet long, but it's coiled. So you're saying, how does something that's 6 feet long fit inside my cell? A cell is tiny. Well, how that happens is it's coiled and it's wrapped around itself and it contains the recipes for protein. So think about it as this recipe. Oh, I'm going to make this protein. I have to have a little of this, a little of that. And it knows how to put those proteins together. So as we repair and rebuild ourselves, the body knows how to do it, and it knows which cells to turn on and which cells to turn off. Because remember, every cell in the body has the same DNA in it. So your eyeball cell has the genes to be able to express toenails. Fortunately, it doesn't happen. We haven't seen quite some of those genetic mutations happening, but given the craziness we're doing in our environment, that may be true someday. But basically, It's supposed to be so that not all the DNA gets turned on at any point in time, and it also gets turned off. And I'm going to take a pause here because I keep hearing a beep and I want to turn that off. There we go. Good. And if anybody has any, you know, anything comes up that you, I'm going to keep my chat open So if something comes up and you can't hear me anymore, let's see, there's the chat. I'm going to keep the chat off to the side. So in big, bold letters, you know, type help, you know, we can't hear you or something along those lines. All right. So yeah, so getting back to it, the DNA tells the cell what traits to express. So it knows that this is an eyeball cell versus this is a toenail cell, and it knows not to express it all. And as we look at some of these genes that code for various metabolic pathways in the body, some of them get turned on and some of them get turned off, and we'll see what environmental factors help to turn them either on or off. So what's the human genome? Well, there was a project that was started in the 1990s, so this is new science. But the human genome is the actual genes, the chromosomes. So we have two sets of 23 chromosomes. We got one set from mom, one set from dad. The genome is the entire set of the 23. But guess what? You know, we're not that different from other creatures. We share 93% of those genetics with the rhesus monkey, 98.5 with chimpanzees, and 99.5 with other humans. So you walk around seeing every human looks unique. There's only a 0.5% difference in their DNA versus your DNA in the genome. Like I said, the genes can be turned on and off, and we're going to look at a lot of factors called the epigenetic factors that help to turn those on or off. SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, are what make us different. We're going to look at what those are. Okay, so you can see the strand, and you see the T and the A, and the A and the T, and the C and the G. Those are those nucleotide bases. All right. So what, how are we coming to study about this? Well, back in the 1990s, 1990 exactly, the Human Genome Project started. And since then, we have mapped out and identified 35,000 genes. More than half of them, we don't even know what they do. And what do you, well, you're going to hear some terms like phenotype versus genotype. Genotype is the actual genes. They're the matched pairs of chromosomes that we looked at before, one from mom, one from dad. All of them are the same except for the sex ones. Males have XY, females have XX. So from that, we say that the sperm actually determines the sex of the child, because the egg looks exactly the same whether the child is going to be male or female. It's whether or not it gets injected with an X sperm or a Y sperm that determines the sex of the baby. Sperm and egg have only one set, right? So they don't have the two sets. They have one, and they come together to make the two in the offspring. The phenotype is the expression of those genes. It's the genes plus the environment. And we're going to use a term called epigenetics as we go on, and you're going to learn what that is and how much the environment determines the expression of the genes. So the phenotype versus the genotype. Single nucleotide polymorphisms, SNPs, they are actually variations in one nucleotide. Remember, there's four. And if a certain gene is supposed to have a CC and it has a CG, that's called a SNP, a single nucleotide polymorphisms. And all the genetic variations that we're going to be looking at are related to SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms. Now, they control the normal variations, right? Our height, our eye color, the color of our hair, our facial features, etc. But they also determine detoxification capacity, how you work cardiovascularly, your digestion, and all the biochemical and physiologic functions are controlled by that. So let's look more closely at what SNPs are. And I know this is a review for a lot of you, but I think it's a good review to always start from that same place. So single nucleotide polymorphisms, there are 3 billion base pairs of genes. Single base pair can get added, deleted, or substituted. What does that mean? Well, you look over here. You've got the DNA, and it's connected with another DNA strand, and this is version 1, CTAAGTA. A SNP, a single nucleotide polymorphism, is a variation in one of those nucleotides, CTAC instead of A, GTA. The version 3, CTAG, GTA. Version 4 is CTAT, GTA. So anytime we're talking about SNPs, it's all it is the variation of one of the nucleotides. Most of the SNPs lead to no observable differences. We've identified 10 million of them already. Most of them lead to no observable differences, but 500,000 of them can now be tested at the same time. And I think it might be up to, you know, more like 900,000 or a million. It's constantly evolving. So any numbers that are in these slides are going to be obsolete in a day or two as science moves on. Many of them, like I said, lead to normal variations, the eye color, the hair color, the shape of the nose, etc. Others contribute to disease and nutrient imbalances. Those are the ones that we're going to be looking at today. So why should we test for SNPs? Well, we want to look to see if there are any hidden gene variations that you don't really know about that could lead to chronic disease. And as you're working with clients, what that means is they have a tendency to lean towards that disease. Doesn't mean they have that and doesn't mean they're going to get it. It just means that they had a tendency towards it. And if you know that somebody has a tendency towards a particular disease, you can help them with the diet and lifestyle factors to help prevent the expression of that disease. Okay, so the modifying it, you can actually look at more targeted nutrients to give them better, cleaner environments to give them. And of course, we want everybody to eat the most pristine diet and live in the most pristine environment. But if they have a genetic tendency that may predispose them towards a specific disease, you can help them better take better care of themselves. One of the things that occurred to me just a little while ago was that our genes determine how much abuse we can give our bodies, right? So somebody who has like these genes that everything is strong and healthy and all their pathways are healthy may be able to occasionally have dietary indiscretions or go into a toxic place and not be bothered. But then we have the canaries in the coal mine. I'm sure everybody's heard that expression before, but that relates to folks, people, animals, species who are weaker than others, who are going to be much more sensitive to environmental toxins. So they would bring the canary into the coal mine because the canary was more sensitive to the buildup of toxic fumes in there. And if the canary died, the people got out. They sacrificed the canary. So that expression has become very common. We know I work with a lot of clients who are the canaries in the coal mine. In fact, we probably all work with mostly the clients who are more tending towards the canary in the coal mine than not. Because face it, everybody out there is doing all these abusive things to their bodies in terms of environmental exposure, stress, and food. And a percentage of them, it's quite a large percent, but not 100%, get ill from it. So some are more sensitive than others. So let's talk about how they're reported on some of the reports that we'll look at. The wild type is what's called normal. You might see it listed as normal. You might see it in the color green and you might see it as a minus minus. So that means mom gave you good gene, dad gave you good gene, everything's good. Heterozygous is you got a SNP from one parent. It's expressed as a plus minus and it's in yellow. And homozygous is you got that SNP from both parents, plus, plus. And so what you'll see down at the bottom is an example just pulled from one of the reports. I think this is a genetic genie report. We'll talk about what all those reports are. And this gives you the SNP, and it gives you what's called the RSID, which is a way of categorizing these and cataloging them. And in this particular case, this person has an AA, and AA is considered the normal. So this is the wild type, and it's green. The GG in this particular SNP, CYP1B1, it shouldn't be GG. It should be something else, right? So in that case, it's a plus plus, it's red, it's a homozygous SNP. And then this one down here, the 1B1 as a CG, so now we know what it should be is a CC. So if you look at the 1B1 here, it should be a TT. That's what's here. So, these are three different versions of it. Okay. So this one in particular is a CG and it's a plus minus and it's yellow. So that's a heterozygous. So homozygous is you got a SNP from both parents. That's usually the worst outcome. It's like that particular function might be reduced by up to 80%. And then yellow, which is heterozygous, and then green, which is the normal, which is wild type. They call it wild type. All right. So let's talk about nutrigenomics. We throw that word around. What does it actually mean? Well, it actually is the effect of food and nutrients on the gene expression and the influence of genetic variation on nutrition. So it goes both ways. Certain foods and nutrients and toxins in the environment can turn on or off a gene. Certain genetic variations are going to influence how well a person absorbs certain nutrients. So the correlation between single nucleotide polymorphism, SNPs, and the nutrients absorption, metabolic elimination, and biological effects would be the nutrigenomics. So here's the good news. Only 5% of the genetic expression is the genes. 95% is in your control, and it's the epigenetics. And the reason that's such good news is, right, we can't change the genes we got. We can only turn them on or off. And 95% of that is controlled by epigenetic factors. So let's look at what some of those epigenetic factors are. So the genes are just a piece of the pie, right? We've got environment, we've got infectious disease, we've got stressors, just a piece of the pie. Doesn't mean you're going to get Alzheimer's because you have an APOE44 gene. It means that you're more prone to that and you're going to be more sensitive to the environmental abuses that might lead that gene to express. So if we want to look at it, we look at all the different environmental factors that play in to expression of the genes. So if we look at the genes as this orange circle, then we look at the nutrition as the green and the stress and lifestyle and the environment, and they're all overlapping in the middle. That's what we have control over it, where the genes overlap with all of these factors. That's where we have the most epigenetic control. Now, all of these places we have it. It's just showing that the middle one is where they all come together. So that is how it's affected, right? The lifestyle factors express and control it. That's what nutrigenomics is about. All of these things play into the epigenetic stress that's placed, and it can lead to chronic inflammation. So psychosocial stress, right? The environment, the people, the psychological factors, the leaky gut, T-cell dysfunction, which is part of the immune system, environment, like, you know, are there PCBs in your environment? Is there mold in the environment? Diabetes, cancer, depression, cardiovascular disease, obesity, the diet, early life stress. All of these things play into the stressors that are going on to the person. And all of these stressors lead to some of the disease manifestations. So what influences gene expression? What are those factors and how can you help your client to control these things? We're going to go into a lot more detail in this at the end of the presentation, but I just want to start with that so we can begin with the end in mind. Well, there's the foundational lifestyle and diet, what I like to call the body freedom foundations. Those are the foundational habits and diet that emphasize clean, whole foods, antioxidant-rich diet, clean environment, low stress, sleep, that helps the expression of the genes to be optimized. Vitamin mineral balance and the forms that someone take, that can express the genes, that affect the genes in the way they're expressed. Gut health, blood sugar balance, the mitochondria, which are the powerhouses of every cell, the function of that affects gene influence, gene expression. Metabolic toxins are built up as a result of normal body function. So homocysteine is built up as a function of the normal methylation pathways when we have insufficiencies of certain nutrients. Methylmalonic acid is built up when we have insufficient vitamin B12 to take the process all the way through to the end. And there's so many more lactic acids and all kinds of things that play into here. Adrenal health, super important. The stress levels, the level of cortisol in the body. And then thyroid function. So all of these factors will influence gene expression. Okay, so the genes are just part of it, but it helps you to help the client to choose the correct diet and lifestyle factors. So when would we want to use it? Do we want to run this on everybody? Well, it could be helpful to run on everybody. And if cost wasn't an issue and inconvenience, we could run them on everybody. But when do you really need to do it? Well, when your client says, I've tried everything and nothing seems to help. When they don't respond or they even may get worse with some of the recommendations that you're making, that usually work on most people. when they have a family or personal history of certain conditions and diseases, and if they're currently suffering from a serious illness and you want to do your absolute best to get them optimized. So I just wanted to throw in this kind of evolution. My first exposure to genes was a company called GeneWise. It's no longer around. It was a multi-level marketing company. They tested 12 SNPs. And they basically did it to sell supplements, quite frankly. So I wasn't real impressed. The next one that I did, and that was a couple of $100s, was Holistic Health International, Dr. Amy Yasko's company, holistichealth.com. And that was back in the day when there weren't a lot of options. So I had actually had, I can't remember whose I had done that way. It might have been my husband's or a couple of people that I was working with and had those done. It was very expensive, like $400 to get it. They did about 36 SNPs. Genova Diagnostics still does theirs, but they do individual panels. When you add up all those panels for testing, it could cost $2,500. They have a cardiovascular, a detoxification one. They have a skin one. They have all kinds of different panels. And then there's something called Pathway Fit, which is more of from a fitness lifestyle kind of perspective. They don't go into the specific genes all that much. They basically will say, oh, you tend to be a fat burner. You tend to be do better on a high carb diet. You tend to do better on a high protein diet. You tend to do better on this, that, or the other thing. A nice report, but it's not as comprehensive. 23andMe gives you a very comprehensive report. Or they do a number of genes, like 500,000 or so, but their report's kind of, their report is just really kind of, it's meant for the general public. It'll say you have a 2% increase in risk of this disease or a 20% risk increase in that or a 5% decrease in that. But the advantage of it is that anybody can read it. The disadvantage is it doesn't really give us a lot of the really good stuff that we want to know about the nutrients, about the pathways, about particular metabolic things, that the report. Then there's this thing called Smart DNA, but it's very complicated. It requires a practitioner to interpret, and I think it's somewhere in the $1,400 to $1,500 range. And then SpectraCell, which just does MTHFR, and we'll get into what MTHFR is in a bit. So I generally run the SNPs through 23andMe, and then we have certain reports that we'll share with you what they are to get some more insight as to what's actually going on. So let's just talk a little bit more geeky. We're going to get geeky in this presentation. So take a lot of notes. You've got the slides. If you haven't opened up the email that came about an hour ago, that should have a copy of the slides. And you'll have access to this recording to watch over and over and over again. So it's like a layer on top of the genes. And it alters the way the genes are expressed, whether the gene is silenced or activated. Stem cells get their organ-specific functions turned on through epigenetic processes, stem cells being those deep cells that create the early-on cells that create the full function later on. The entire library of DNA is in the cell, but only certain pieces are activated or turned on via methylation. So methylation is a very important factor for making sure that your eyeball cells express eyeball cells instead of eyeball genes instead of toenail, right? And then a change in the gene expression can result from environmental factors or stressors that just go beyond the tipping point. Maybe your particular genes, you can tolerate this much stress. You know, a bucket full of stress. Somebody else can tolerate two buckets full. Somebody else can only tolerate a thimble full. Once you go on your own tipping point, that's when you develop cancer and tumors and things like that. So here's just a little diagram, and this was putting together what the different things are that weigh on the epigenetic modulation. Diet, toxins, inflammation, hypoxia, maternal care, early life experience, aging, chemicals, radiation. All of those things modulate the epigenetic expression, which affects the DNA methylation. And that's how the genes get turned on and off through methylation, histone modification, and, non-coding RNAs. So, that affects the genome DNA and then the stability of the genes, how strong they are, how much they're able to repair the expression, and that develops whether somebody's going to get into a state of pathology. Okay. So the epigenetic factors are there, and we don't know. We can't predict how long it's going to take for those factors to actually do enough damage to move us into the disease, the genesis of disease. But it's a good thing to know. So we're going to go into a little more on methylation. So I'm going to check to see if there are any questions coming in. Nope, we're good. Is everybody okay right now? Was that mostly a review? Good review? And now we'll get into more detail, more geeky stuff. Okay. So methylation. All right, let's go. All right. So the way I like to describe methylation is playing hot potato with this methyl group. What's a methyl group? It's a carbon and three hydrogens. Okay, and it looks exactly like it looks right there, methyl group on the screen. We have these chemicals in the body that are considered methyl donors. They basically can pass that methyl group on to someone else. So we have SAMe, acetyl-acetylmethionine, folate, which is folic acid, people know it as, or vitamin B9, vitamin B12, a cobalamin, TMG, trimethylglycine, also known as betaine, DMG, dimethylglycine, and DMAE, diamine ethanolamine. I can never say all that. Anyway, DMAE is easier to say. So these are methyl donors. These are basically passing it around. And we're going to look at some of the pathways. And again, you're not going to memorize these in one shot. And the more you look at them, the more you start to see them in your mind. Now I can actually see when somebody starts describing things, I can see what those different pathways look like and know a lot of what's going on in there without really looking. All the little minute details and the tiny cofactors, I like to look up because I like to leave my brain a little open for new information. I don't like to do things when I can look things up, memorize it when you can look it up, unless it just happens to get memorized. So what is methylation? There are these special tags that affect the expression of a gene. It can change the shape and alter the expression. Okay, so it's an epigenetic process that enables us to be who we are at the DNA. So what does that mean? It's basically these methyl groups get into the DNA and we get to the site of the DNA and we can repair, we can reproduce, we can turn it on and off. Okay. We have to have methylation functioning properly to be healthy. And we're going to look at what happens when methylation doesn't go right. And we're going to look at it in terms of the kinds of symptoms and conditions that can develop. So poor functioning methylation allows you to become ill. It is indeed one of the most important biological processes in our body. No doubt about it. So what does it do? It turns on and off genes and it synthesizes DNA. Like the DNA needs to be repaired. It doesn't last forever. We have the telomeres that say how long the DNA is going to continue to reproduce and then the life is done. It helps to process toxins. So in liver detoxification, one of the pathways in phase 2 liver detoxification is methylation. Builds and metabolizes neurotransmitters. So those neurotransmitters that affect brain function and nervous system function, epinephrine, norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine, and melatonin all have methylation plays a role in their building and their metabolizing. So breaking them down after they're used up. Helps to process hormones. So if you've ever looked at a Dutch test and it tells you the ratio between the hydroxyestrone and the methyl. That's what that is. It's a methylation process. And if we don't have enough methylation, we don't have powerful enough methylation, we're not going to convert to those safer forms of estrogen that don't do damage and don't cause proliferative type diseases like, you know, cancers of the uterus and breast. Helps to build immune cells. So the T cells, the NK cells, natural killer cells, all those are immune system cells and methylation helps them to be built. Helps to process energy, so it's important in mitochondrial function for CoQ10, carnitine, creatine, and ATP production. It helps to produce the myelin sheaths, and without the myelin sheaths, the nerve transmission is sluggish. Your brain says, move your toe, and a few seconds later, the toe moves, and that's what happens in multiple sclerosis, where the myelin sheaths have been damaged and the transmission is very slow and people slowly lose the function of their limbs. And it helps to build and maintain cell membranes. And an important chemical in there is phosphatidylcholine. So phospholipids are going to play in here. All right. What disrupts methylation? All right. What are people doing in their daily lives? Well, a lot of medications have an effect and disrupt methylation. So medications like antacids, methotrexate, metformin, nitric oxide, these are not oddball, strange medications that are not used. These are common medications. Nutrient deficiencies, we see that all the time. Why? Because people are eating processed food diets and they're disrupting their nutrients. So the ones that are most important that disrupt methylation, if they're deficient, zinc, vitamin B2, or riboflavin, magnesium, cysteine, vitamin B6, vitamin B12, and folate. What else? Environmental toxicity. We are surrounded by it, guys. Acetaldehyde, arsenic, mercury, high copper, all kinds of chemicals, heavy metals, lead, all of these things play in to disrupting methylation. Nutrient excess. What does that mean? Well, you know, certain nutrients, even if people think that, oh, more is better, but it's not. So too much dimethylglycine, SAMe, methylfolate, and niacin can actually disrupt methylation. And I've seen people who've had tests done, limited tests done, had a doctor that didn't, you know, really study up on it and put them on massive doses of SAMe or niacin and or methylfolate, and they've gotten horrible results, anxious or you know, hallucinatory and all that. Genetic mutations obviously are going to affect it, so if we don't have the right mechanism. Mental state. Whenever stress and under stress or anxiety or lack of sleep, any of those unstable mental states can affect and disrupt methylation. What about the fats that people eat? What about those candy bars? What about the things that they're eating that contain hydrogenated and oxidized fats? And it's not just hydrogenated and margarine and Crisco and those sorts of things that have the oxidized fats, but anytime you heat a polyunsaturated fat above 118 degrees, you have oxidized fats. So a lot of these fats that people are getting in the bottles, the oils, the mazola, the Wesson oil, the 100% organic safflower oil, those are all oxidized because they've been heated above 118. They're exposed to light. So, you know, you think about, oh, my people don't eat Crisco because I educated them, but they do eat a lot of these things and it depends on their tolerance level. Some people can't ever do it. So they're very meticulous when they go to a restaurant. Other people can tolerate a little bit of it. And that's some of the stuff to keep in mind when you're teaching people to do stuff. They're doing a great job, but they don't seem to be getting the great results that you expect or you. Processed high glycemic foods. People are eating this all the time, right? Sugar, flour, grains, charred meat. People love their barbecues, right? Well, that produces heterocyclic amines, very potent carcinogenic compounds. And depending on how well your cytochrome P450 system is, we'll talk about that in a bit, you may not tolerate that very well. And it's going to accelerate the cell destruction. Then there's things that we're always talking to people about, gluten and dairy and caffeine and excess alcohol. All of these can disrupt methylation. Well, so what's the risk? Okay, so SNPs can lead to so many things. I mean, pretty much anything. I mean, it should say et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, atherosclerosis, schizophrenia. I mean, you name it is on that side. Neural tube defects, Down syndrome, MS, Huntington's, all the autoimmune diseases. All of these, the SNPs can lead to this. So if the environment and the SNP come, you know, they hit it right, that right combination, people are going to get sick. And this is a good way to help them to recover. So the main methylation SNPs are these that I've listed here. There are a lot more. MTHFR, the C677T is the most common one. It's the most talked about one. The MTHFR 1298C. Now, what do those numbers mean? Those numbers generally mean the location of that particular gene, of that particular SNP on the gene itself. The C and the T in this particular case means, like the C677T, it means the C is exchanged for a T. Not all of them are so straightforward. There's also the MTRR, MTR. We're going to go into all of these in detail, BHMT, CMDS, and COMT. We're going to go into all of these. So by the end of here, you'll at least have heard them and you'll know where in the slides to go look. I've given you, in addition to these kinds of slides, there's a lot of chart type slides that I recommend that you print out and put in a little binder or a little folder to keep handy as you start to do the work and work with people on this. About 45% of the population has one copy of MTHFR C677T. So it's like, wait a minute, if this is a SNP, if this is an alteration, if this is a quote-unquote mutation, why is it that 45% of the population has it? 90% of those with chronic disease have a copy of it. I personally have two copies. I have copies of both the C677T and the 1298C. So I have that. So I have one copy. I'm in the 45%, but I also have the 1298C. I've seen a few people with the double C677T. That's a very small percentage of the population has that. So if you have that, then your methylation is going to be impaired dramatically and you have to listen up. So here's some other SNPs, and we're going to go through most of these in a little bit more detail, but I've given this to you on a list. This is the ones that's on a test, the test interpretation report called Genetic Genie. Okay, so we'll go through each of these in turn, and I'll tell you what they are. Okay, guys, this is it. There's going to be a test at the end of this. I want you to memorize this. Okay, so these are charts. You've probably seen them before, and it's going to help you to see visually where all these come in. Like right now, this may look like gobbledygook. I'm going to give you a little bit of an explanation, and the more we go through this presentation and build on it, the more you're going to understand. So on the right, I'm going to see if I can get my little, there it is, annotate, and see if I can get like a red marker so we can, okay. All right, let's see. Yeah, there we go. All right, so this cycle here, right here, okay, right above me, this is the cycle where homocysteine gets broken down and SAMe gets created. Why are these important? SAMe is our big old methyl donor. The SAMe is one of our most important methyl donors, and it actually feeds those methyl groups right into the DNA repair process right here. You see it? Okay. So that's the SAMe. Homocysteine is important for the opposite reason. Homocysteine, when it builds up, is damaging to blood vessel linings, can contribute to cardiovascular disease risk, also damaging to brain cells and neurotransmitter synapses. So homocysteine we want reduced, not down to zero. It's just a normal metabolic process, but we need this homocysteine to reduce. On a lab test, I like to see it, 4 to 6. Okay, so we can tell how well this pathway is working by the level of homocysteine. So over on the left-hand side, we've got where our MTHFR is working. You see this one, MTHFR? Okay. What is MTHFR? Methylene tetrahydrofolic folate reductase. And it basically is creating methyl folate, 5-methyl folate, 5-methyl tetrahydrofolic acid. That's what 5-methyl THF is. It's a methyl donor. So we go through this other process where we take in the folate and it gets converted a couple of times around, gets methylated, turns into 5-methyl. And then comes up here where it meets with the B12 and it hands off the methyl group to the B12 through these two enzymes, MTRR and MTR. Again, we'll look at these in a little more detail. And then the B12 then takes the methyl group and adds it to the homocysteine and converts it into methionine. So we're basically taking a toxic substance, turning it into a safer amino acid. The amino acid methionine then gets converted into SAMe, and SAMe donates its methyl group and goes right into DNA repair. Seems like a lot of work, right? Like, why isn't it just like do it directly? Why do we have to go through all that process? I don't think we know enough about why and the wherefores. There's a lot of possibilities here. But here's the other thing. So homocysteine goes around the circle, okay, And it gets regenerated down here back into homocysteine. And then it goes around again. Now, homocysteine can also come down here, and we're going to look later at the sulfation pathway. Right. So how else can homocysteine get broken down? Well, there's a shortcut through the middle and an enzyme called BHMT, and it requires dimethylglycine, trimethylglycine, trimethyl is betaine. So basically the homocysteine gets converted. Now, when we're looking at people's genes, we're looking at the status of these to see how well they're going to methylate and how well they're going to produce SAMe and how well they're going to break down homocysteine. So the genes that we're looking at here, MTHFR, MTR, MTRR, BHMT, and then over here we have AHCY. This is just an enzyme, AHCY. And we'll look at those in a little bit more detail. But this is what this looks like. So when you hear this, all this talk about methylation and MTHFR, it's basically this process gets slowed down. Okay? And we'll look at this part over here. This is more the neurotransmitters stuff right here. Neurotransmitters. And that's where the dopamine and it's called the BH4 cycle. Tyrosine, tryptophan, etc. All right? How are we doing so far? Let me go back and get my pointer. How do I go back and get my pointer? I can't move it with my pointer without my pointer. Okay. I'm not used to using this, guys. Ah, maybe this is it. No? Okay. Eraser, spotlight, draw, text. Okay. Mouse. Thank you. All right. So I'm going to move to the next one. I'm going to look to see if anybody... Okay. All right. You guys doing okay? Everybody following? Is this a review for most of you? I'm going to erase. I like this. I can erase. All right. This is another way of looking at that same pathway. This is from Ben Lynch, Seeking Health. And you can purchase these in separate, each one of these is a separate sheet. They have them as PDFs, or they'll send them to you. I have a big chart that sits on my wall. I don't actually have room for it, but I have it that I can pull out and put up on my wall if I want to look at it. But it's a big chart because there's a lot of little writing on here, right? This is what we were just looking at. Let me get up here. I don't want the eraser anymore. I want this. Okay. I don't know how to do this. Draw. Okay. Draw. Squiggle. All right. So this is what we were looking at before. Here's where homocysteine is. It's hard to read. It's tiny, right? Well, I said to you that homocysteine can also come down and be reduced. And so in order for homocysteine to go around the circle, get reduced and not build up, we need a significant amount of folate, vitamin B12, folate and vitamin B12. Now, the other way that homocysteine can be reduced is going down to the sulfation pathway. That's what this is. And it uses a gene called CBS. And we need vitamin B6 in order for it to go down. So if ever you've looked at any formulas that are meant to help people reduce their homocysteine, they contain in general at least vitamin B6, vitamin B12, and folate. Those three. There's usually some other things in there to help the metabolism as well. Okay, we'll get into this pathway a little bit later. I just wanted to show you that there's more than one way to skin a cat, as they say, and I don't like that term, but there's more than one way to draw, and a lot of authors have drawn it. Okay, so we're going to go to the next one. This one is actually my more favorite one, and this was actually put together by one of our members, Michaeline Casey, and she was in one of our very first classes, and she spoke at our very first Shine, and she had made some really cool slides, so I gave her credit for this slide, which she created back in 2014, and I like it because it's pretty, right? Oh, what happens over here? Well, this is the SAMe factory. That's the methionine cycle, right? BHMT is in the middle. MTR, MTRR is here. This is the organic greens folate cycle because we need greens to take people through this cycle. Greens are the best source of folate. So we have the MTHFR here. The BH4 is the neurotransmitter, the feeling good cycle. She called it the BH4. And then there's the waste management cycle, which is the ammonia cycle, which actually lives down here. And then there's the ATP, the energy cycle. So she drew them and put things on them so that you can remember it. So you've got that chart that you can look back at. Okay. And this is just to show you that from both of these areas, we go into DNA repair. So there's a cycle coming off of the folate cycle that leads to, you know, purine synthesis and, DNA synthesis, DNA repair and synthesis. And over here from the CME part, it goes to DNA methylation. Okay. So create it, repair it, and methylate, express it. So let's take a look at the good old fashioned, no, the famous MTHFR. A lot of people, that's what they know. Oh, my doctor did my genes. He did MTHFR. So MTHFR is methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase. Two different main versions of it, C677T and A1298C. Now, if you were to get a full-blown genetic panel and you were run it through a company called MTHFR Support, they have a 49-page report, and you're going to see lots of these, maybe a dozen or more MTHFRs. The ones that have been found to be clinically significant are the C677T and the 1298C. So let's look at what they do. Well, C677T helps to convert homocysteine to methionine, and then that's converted to SAMe. That's what we just looked at in that pathway. When people have this in it, it can lead to high homocysteine. Why? Well, because the homocysteine isn't getting converted. When they have the C677T along with COMT, catecholamine O-methyltransferase, we're going to look at that one later. When they have both of those SNPs, it can actually lead to mood swings. So we're really careful with supplementing with the methyl groups when they have that COMT, and we'll talk about that in a bit. A298C, we found that most of the time the people that have it don't end up with elevated homocysteine. Now, I have both of these. So my tendency would be to have elevated homocysteine if I weren't really paying attention and eating my greens and keeping my nutrient levels up and taking care of myself, because I have both of these. And it can lead to elevated ammonia and decreased neurotransmitters, right? So that's what they've found, is that in the 1298C, we tend to see more of the homocysteine going down to the pathway, the sulfur pathway, and then producing ammonia, and less of it going off to make neurotransmitters. So what kind of problems can we have if we have MTHFR gene, or if your client has an MTHFR gene? Well, we already talked about increased homocysteine, which leads to increased risk of cardiovascular disease or thrombosis. Insufficient substrates for DNA repair synthesis and methylation, which makes you at higher risk for cancer. Increased risk of miscarriage. Women who have MTHFR, in particular the double MTHFR, have a much higher risk of miscarriage, especially recurrent miscarriage. Neurotransmitter problems, problems with excess dopamine or not enough dopamine. And then here's the thing. You've got to be super careful with somebody with an MTHFR to avoid synthetic folic acid. Folic acid is different from folate. The form of folate we're looking to help people with here is L-methyl tetrahydrofolic acid. Okay, not folic acid, not synthetic. And we'll look at that in a little bit more closely as to why. Because folic acid blocks the methylfolate at the blood-brain barrier, the BBB. Excess folic acid, synthetic, has been shown to be attributed to increased risk of cancer. Now, here's another thing. Dairy products can block the folate receptors, especially in the brain. So FOLR 1, 2, and 3. So here's the thing. You know, you have somebody who has brain fog or has some issues with neurotransmitter function. Are they eating dairy? It's yet another reason to get people to watch their dairy intake, especially if they have an MTHFR issue and they also have any one of these genes impaired. Right. So let's look at possible problems that you might see symptom wise. You may see them with high blood pressure, delayed onset of speech, muscle pain, insomnia, irritable bowel, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, hand tremors, memory loss, headaches, and brain fog. So right away, when people see hand tremor, any kind of tremor, they're thinking, oh my God, it's Parkinson's. Well, it could be an MTHFR. And they can address that via the diet lifestyle things that we're going to talk about later. And brain fog, a lot of people have it. So we want to make sure that if people are having these symptoms and you're cleaning up their diet, or they claim to be cleaning up their diet and they're not getting as well as they could, that we look at the genes. What else? Some signs that you might see, you know, these are in terms of chemical signs. Elevated ammonia levels, decreased dopamine, decreased serotonin, decreased epinephrine and norepinephrine, decreased nitric oxide, elevated blood pressure, muscle tenderness, ulcers, and preeclampsia. Preeclampsia being, you know, that problem that women have in the third trimester of pregnancy where the blood pressure goes real high and is at risk. So these are important considerations. Lynette wants to know, how do you know if you have elevated ammonia levels? You can do a test to see that. Actually, when you run amino acid testing, usually they'll run it, especially urine amino acid testing, you can see that. And you can also tell by the smell of their urine. The urine's going to smell very ammonia-like on a consistent basis. Some people may have it occasionally, but no, it shouldn't smell like that all the time. So what other conditions? Okay. Possible conditions, fibromyalgia, we mentioned some of these, chronic fatigue, autism. See, I first got involved with this through the work of Dr. Amy Yasko, and she works with autistic kids. And she's discovered that autistic kids tend to have certain variations, certain SNPs, and MTHFR is very common. Depression, insomnia, ADD, irritable bowel, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, recurrent miscarriages, Raynaud's, okay, migraines, erectile dysfunction. So it's really important to address these SNPs. And we'll talk about how to address them later. Let's see. Great Plains. Yep. Yep. So who's impacted by it? Well, like we said, approximately 45% of the population has one copy of the MTHFR C677T. 90% with chronic disease have one copy. And Dr. Ben Lynch, who is one of our top researchers these days in this area, he recommends just everybody be tested, so you know. Chances are good you have it. This is just a graphical view of what it really means to have this. So if you look at the reactions, you know, when these are enzymes, right? It's methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, ACE is ACE, ASE. Sorry, that's how enzymes end. And these enzymes catalyze a reaction. So if the enzyme isn't working properly, the reaction is going to be slow. So you look at it as with the enzyme, the energy, the process of the reaction, it just flows, right? It just kind of goes through. And that's down here at the bottom. But without the enzyme to support that function, it's like climbing a wall. It takes a lot to get that enzyme to work properly and then come down. With the double mutation, so heterozygous is single and homozygous is double. With the double mutation, it's estimated that about 75% of the function is lost. With heterozygous, 20%. Big difference. I've seen as much as 30% too. Right? Yeah. This is throwing in some diet that is important for it. So we can affect the thing. We're sitting there thinking, what supplements should be taken? I think it's a big mistake when people get into the this for that approach with methylation. Oh, what enzymes, what hormones should I take? What nutrients should I take? What herbs should I take? We have to look at it from diet, right? So there's a lot of nutrients required for methylation. Choline, creatine, B12, carnitine, methionine, B6, okay? And the diet is there. Greens in the diet provide folate. Tetrahydrofolate, right? Greens in the diet affect all of these things. The vitamin levels, right? The diet, it's all over the place. What's happening in the diet? So the diet is the first place that you want to look. Now, if you look down below, remember we said homocysteine and it'll go down the stream into the sulfur? Well, it goes into cystathionine, which requires B6. It goes from cystathionine into cysteine, which requires B6. Then it goes to glutathione. And so if we don't have enough B6, we can have reduced levels of glutathione. Now, before you jump in and try to give people glutathione, let's work at their food. Let's work at their whole food diet to get them B6 or give them a B6 supplement to start. Okay. The biggest problem I see with supplementing with glutathione is if you give it too much, then it slows down this conversion from cysteine. And then there's some other pathways over here where the sulfur from these gets backed up and goes down and gets converted into sulfites and sulfates, which can cause brain fog and other kinds of symptoms. So that's too much glutathione. It's not like it's, oh yeah, it's good. We need more. Little is good, more is better. It's not true, because you can actually cause these pathways to back up. And as you saw on that previous picture, they're complicated pathways. And we don't know what we don't know, right? You don't have these things memorized. So I go slowly when I'm supplementing with things. I try to just use food amounts. And it's just very coincidental. This is not a relative of mine, but the guy that did the studies on this was named Lo Scalzo. Yeah, there we go. Not related though, as far as I know. So what do we need? What kind of dietary interventions? Well, uncooked leafy greens, enzymes. So we need foods that are not highly cooked and processed. And if they are eating a lot of cooked foods, then taking enzymes with it to help the body to replenish the stores. The receptors have to be available, and there's a lot of nutrients that affect receptors, right? Receptors on the cells. Things that get damaged them are nutrient imbalances, homocysteine. Need to be able to transport them. So those proteins that carry these things around the bloodstream are required. And then vitamins and minerals and a specific acidic pH. So B2, B6, and B12 tend to be the most important in addition to the folate. Okay? And then this is just that same picture. I'm going to keep giving it to you over and over until you memorize it. No, you don't have to memorize it. But some people draw it where the reactions are around the edges, and some draw it down the middle, so you get used to seeing it that way. But we go from folate in the diet. If it's folic acid, it goes down through this slow pathway, and it can actually interfere with the methylated. This is unmetabolized folic acid, and we're going to talk about that in a slide or two forward, about what that actually is. But it comes from the synthetic folate, because the body's too slow to be able to keep up. So if somebody's taking, 1,000 micrograms of folic acid, synthetic folic acid, in their prenatal vitamin, for example, which many women are doing because they're told to do it, and nobody's differentiating between methyl tetrahydrofolate and folic acid. And then you get this unmetabolized folic acid, which affects the blood-brain barrier. But there's a bunch of steps that the dietary comes through to get down to the methylated form. And there's different enzymes and pathways that happen along the way. Okay. What I find is that if you're working with somebody, you're trying to figure something out. When I eat this, this happens. When I take this nutrient, that happens. It's to pull out the biochemical pathways and start to work with those. All right, so here's just a list for you of all the genes that are related to folate metabolism. There's the FOLR 1, 2, and 3, which are the receptors for the folate. And what's important in order to keep them working properly is lipids and phospholipids. SLC19A is another membrane that regulates the intracellular folate. Again, lipids and phospholipids are super important. Tetrahydrofolate is important for this ALDH1L1, and that shows you the pathway that it catalyzes. The DHFR shows you the pathway it catalyzes. Again, I don't memorize these things, but what I do find important is what are the nutrients that are supporting this particular enzymatic pathway. And you can see there's a lot of nutrients listed here, right? There's lipids, there's phospholipids, there's tetrahydrofolate. NAD, which is niacin adenosine dinucleotide, is a form of vitamin B3, niacin. We've got magnesium, folate, B6, B2. So people who are eating processed foods, guys, right? They're eating this stuff that has all the nutrients removed. All the B vitamins are removed. They're low in minerals. So many people don't eat enough greens to get enough magnesium, let alone tetrahydrofolate. we need to make sure that they're adequate in these functions, or else their methylation won't work properly, which means detoxification, breakdown of hormones, breakdown of neurotransmitters, and of course, repair and synthesis and methylation of the DNA. Whew, a lot of stuff, huh? All right, so let's talk about synthetic versus non-synthetic. And the first thing I have people do is I want them to look at their vitamins and find out if there's any folic acid in them. If they have an MTHFR mutation, it's mandatory that they get off of it. If they don't, it's still a good idea. So let me show you the difference between folic acid and methylfolate. It's this red CH3, the hot potato, right? And so that makes all the difference in the world. So the different types of folate you're going to see, folic acid, which is synthetic, folinic acid, which is 5-formyl tetrahydrofolate, and it's a part of that cycle, and it's just not quite all the way to the methylated, and that's a decent form, and I'll tell you about some situations when that may be a good form to give someone. And then there's the L-methylfolate, the 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate. You might see it as 5-MTHF. Some of the supplements you'll see, like Thorn has a supplement called 5-MTHF. So what's the problem? Well, it's hard to convert folic acid to folate or MTHF. It's a very slow reaction. Remember, we looked at that before. Right over here, that's the DHFR. Let me get my annotate here. All right, so I am going to show you. This process is very slow, okay? So we basically require a lot of uncooked leafy greens, and it's uncooked because the folate gets destroyed when we cook it. We need the enzymes to be functioning, all these different enzymes along the way, which means that if there's some SNPs that cause those enzymes to be functioning at less than 100%, like say they have some homozygous or heterozygous, those enzymes might be, you know, anywhere from 30 to 80% impaired, it's going to be very slow. So depending on the genetics, folic acid is going to be more or less toxic to the person. So we also need all these vitamins to be intact. And when we don't have enough of them, we're not going to be able to convert it. B2, B6, B12, we need an acidic environment. We need this SHMT enzyme to be working. And a lot of people with leaky gut have impairments there. And we have the other thing is the glycine levels, which affects the creation of glutathione. Okay, so if any of these are impaired, the person isn't going to convert. So in my opinion, just get them off of the synthetic folate, right? Just get rid of it. It doesn't make sense. Now, if they're on a teeny tiny bit, they have a great multi, and the only bad thing about it is it has 50 micrograms of synthetic folate. Unless they have really messed up genetics, they probably handle it okay, and at least until they can get another one. You don't want to have them throw it down the drain. But if they've got a lot of impairments here, and they've got a multivitamin that's got, you know, 800 micrograms of synthetic folic acid, I would encourage them to get rid of it. So what if they waste their $20 or $30? It's well worth it to waste the $20 or $30 and to waste the health. And when we have a buildup of this unmetabolized folic acid, as we'll see on the next slide, we're going to find that folks are going to be getting blood-brain barrier problems. So let's look at that. Let me just erase my lines here, and we'll go back to the mouse. All right, so what is unmetabolized, okay? When the enzymes reach the saturation point, all right, when we don't have enough power, where did it go? Okay, there we go. I was trying to erase this line. Okay, when we don't have enough enzymatic power, we got folic acid, synthetic folic acid, and this DHFR enzyme isn't working properly, we're going to get a buildup of the unmetabolized folic acid. High levels have been associated with cancer. So whenever you read a study that says, oh, excess folic acid might be related to cancer, it's excess synthetic folic acid. Increased levels can decrease the activities of our natural killer cells, and that will increase the risk for cancer. As much as possible throughout this presentation, I've given you links that you can go and do more research. Let's see. Studies show that folic acid is less effective than methylfolate in reducing homocysteine. So if somebody's taking this supplement and it says, oh, this is because they have elevated homocysteine and their medical doctor gave it to them and they go, doesn't work as well. It doesn't work as well if it can actually be done because it's just such a small percentage that's utilized. So what's the action? Have them removed all the fortified foods. So when they get breakfast cereal that says it's fortified, when they get flour that says it's refined and then fortified, it's all the artificial folic acid that's been put in it. Some of the stuff is actually in the B12 patch. So I used to get these B12 patches that had folic acid in it, and I didn't realize it was synthetic folic acid. So whenever you have a product, whenever your client is taking a product that you want to evaluate, you want to look at the folic acid. And if you're not sure, if it doesn't say, you can always call the company. And the way I would do that would be to call the company and say, hey, I see you have 800 micrograms of folic acid in this product. Got it. Thank you. By the way, what's the form of folic acid? If you ask them, is it synthetic? They may just say, oh, no, no, everything we do is natural, right? Because they're not educated. What's the form? I need to know the exact chemical form. Okay. But a lot of the combo B12 products contain folic acid, right? And it's just, it's going to be problematic because the unmetabolized folic acid impacts the uptake at the blood-brain barrier of the methylfolate, right? Methylfolate doesn't increase unmetabolized. You see, it can't. It's right here. It's beyond that. It's just the folate that does that, the folic acid, the synthetic. Okay. Now this is a lot. When once we get to the end of methylation, I'll ask if there's any questions. Yes, Lynette says nutritional yeast is typically fortified with folic acid. Right, absolutely. That's why you got to be really careful what people are taking. So here's some food sources of folate. This was taken directly from whfoods.com, but here's some good sources of folate and how much they have in them. Right. So this is let's see. The microgram amounts, right? 358, okay, in a cup of lentils, right? Spinach has high amounts. Collard greens, turnip greens, beets, these are all high amounts. Now, if they're taking a supplement, it's 800 micrograms, you could easily see how you can get 800 micrograms. So for most part, when people are on a really excellent diet, they may not even need the folate. I personally don't take except maybe once a month I take it. I have a double MTHFR, but I eat so much of the good stuff that has this in it. Now again, these, spinach, it says cooked, so you're not going to get as much from that. You really do need to eat it raw or close to raw to be able to preserve the folic acid in there, the folate in there. Okay. Here's just a list of some of the supplemental forms. L5-MTHF. The L is important. Avoid the R forms. Some of them are called quatrefolate. It's a glucosamine form. Metafolin, which is a calcium form. L-methylfolate and 6S5-methylfolate. These are quality forms, right? You want to avoid them if they don't have the L or the 6S or the quatrefolate or the metfolin. Okay. And then this is just a picture of what it looks like. Okay. This is the tetrahydrofolate. All right. We're almost there. So we're almost finished methylation. Then we have a lot more to get into. So before addressing MTHFR, we want to look at what's their foundational lifestyle and diet. We don't want to just say, oh, we got to give this person a ton of methylfolate. It can actually be a problem if you don't know the rest of their genes and you just give them that. It's a small percentage of people, by the way, but it's a large percentage of chronically ill people. And I've seen it happen where people are given these massive doses of folate as a result of their MTHFR test coming back. And they end up with anxiety and depression and they get suicidal and they get homicidal. And it's not good. It's not pretty. So I'm really careful if I see somebody has the MTHFR and their diet still needs a lot of work and I want to supplement them with folate, I'm going to get a liposomal folate and I'm going to give them one drop at a time. And one drop has a teeny tiny amount. And I'm going to give them two drops and three. And I'm going to watch to make sure and tell them to watch that they make sure that they don't become anxious. Okay, so the foundational lifestyle is important. Remove all the synthetic folic acid. Absolutely important. Improve their B12 status. Test their homocysteine levels to see if they're actually in the state where their homocysteine is building up. And if it is, then you really do need to address this quickly. Reduce the oxidative stress. That's true of just about anything, right? We want to reduce oxidative stress, evaluate their thyroid, address their mitochondria. All of these are really important before you just jump right in and throw some folate at it, because there can be some downsides, and we're going to look at that when we look at methyl trapping. So let's look at some of the other SNPs related to the methylation, and then we'll open up for questions. Martha, a good reason not to eat processed or packaged foods is that they're typically had folic acid added to it because, yep, so that's good to know. I mean, good to keep in mind. So basically, the MTR, which is 5-methyltetrahydrofolate homocysteine methyl transferase, it transfers a methyl group from methyl B12 to homocysteine to become methyl methionine, and it's a zinc-dependent SNP. I particularly have this one. This enzyme is zinc dependent. I have the SNP as a homozygous. So I have some things that suggest I need to make sure I'm keeping my B12 levels up. It increases the need for B12. And when it's done with the C677T, it can lead to persistently high homocysteine levels, right? So somebody has the MTR and they have an MTHFR. You've got to be really careful and monitor those homocysteine levels every year and make sure that they're getting good forms of food form, B vitamins, and then whatever supplementation you find is necessary. MTRR is the 5-methyltetrahydrofolate homocysteine methyltransferase reductase, MTRR. It remethylates cobalamin with methylfolate. So, and the folate then goes back into the folate cycle. This one requires vitamin B2 in the form of flavonoid adenosine diphosphate, FAD, which is a Krebs cycle intermediate. Okay, this is very important for doing this. So as we looked at our pathway, let's see if I had that picture here. Yeah, I do. Good. Yay. So if we look here, the MTRR and the MTR are here. So if you look at this pathway over, I'm going to just put a little purple over here. This is the path. Whoops. Draw purple. Okay. Why isn't it working? There we go. Okay, this is the path I'm talking about. We take our food, O-D, our food comes in with the methyl, the folate in the food form folate. It comes around and it comes down to the MTHFR enzyme works, gets it methylated. And then that comes around and the folate wants to give its little methyl group over here, right? We need the MTR and the MTRR to be working properly. And here's the thing, in order to attach to the homocysteine and turn it into methionine. But here's the thing. If we give a person too much folate and they have impairments of the MTRR and the MTR and deficiency in B12 or relative deficiency, they're going to get a buildup of those methyl groups here. It's called methyl trapping. And that can lead to symptoms. Okay, so it's super important here, super important that we're not over supplementing people just because we heard that we need to give them folate when it comes to these mutations, SNPs. I don't like to call them mutations. It's common language, but I try not to. All right, so we're going to get rid of this. Oops, how do I get rid of it? Okay, eraser. Why is my eraser not working? There we go. There we go. All right. Now we have it. So let's look at BHMT. Look at where BHMT is. It's right in the middle. So if we do have some impairments with the MTR, MTRR, then the homocysteine can be converted to methionine through the BHMT. So rather than going around the long way, it goes through the middle. Okay, so it's a shortcut. Helps convert betaine and homocysteine into methionine. Okay, and again, remember this. This goes down to glutathione over here. AHCY, acetylcysteine homocysteine hydrolase. Over here, it's taking, after the SAMe, it's going to take that back. The SAMe donates its methyl groups, and it comes back down to homocysteine. And that's with the AHCY. It transfers energy as ADP and ATP and ADP. It helps to promote sleep and suppress arousal. So this is an important one for people who are having difficulty sleeping, and we don't think about that too much. And that's why SAMe sometimes is very helpful for people, because it helps to push this. COMT. You guys have, a lot of you have heard of this. I speak about it quite a bit. Catecholamine O-methyltransferase. What it does is transfers a methyl group from SAMe to the catecholamine neurotransmitters, dopamine, epinephrine, norepinephrine. It also transfers a methyl group from SAMe to the catechol hormones, so estrogen. So this is one of the ways that estrogen gets converted to the methyl estrogen, methylestrone, 2-hydroxyestrone gets converted to methoxyestrone, and that helps to make it safe for removal eventually from the body. It's involved in brain function, has to do with personality, short-term memory, abstract thinking, emotions. It has to do with the emotions of anxiety in particular, and attention span. And here's the problem that happens a lot. When somebody has a homozygous, meaning they got the red, right? The one from mom, one from dad, on the COMT, it's a problem with taking too many methyl donors. So if somebody has this COMT that's homozygous, and they're given 5 grams of folate, methyl folate, and 5 grams of methyl B12, which, by the way, sounds like a lot, but it's not too uncommon that docs will do that. If they do that without checking to make sure that they don't have a homozygous COMT, they can get that person into trouble, and they become irritable and cranky, and they become aggressive. So it's really important that you go slowly when giving methyl groups, unless you for sure know their genetics. And if they're the sensitive type, right, they tell you they're the canary in the coal mine, like they really have trouble with adding new enzymes and new supplements, then it's super important to go really slowly. I'm a fan of going slowly with people with just about every nutrient that you're going to give them, for most people, because when they're chronically ill, they tend to be more sensitive. Okay, so MAO, monoamine oxidase, breaks down serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. And again, when we have this COMT homozygous combined with an MAO SNP, they're likely to have OCD, mood swings, be aggressive, violent, and have personality disorders. And the MAO tends to be sex-linked, so it's carried on down from the mom. So you don't inherit anything from dad. You just get it from mom. I remember years ago, before I got my stuff tested, and I remember teasing my husband a couple of times and saying, "Oh my God, you're getting just like your mother. You must have inherited her OCD." And then we did his test, and he had a homozygous COMT, and he had an MAO from her. So we said, yeah, I guess he did. Now, we've since, you know, gotten his nutrition up, and he's lost a lot of those traits. And as long as we keep his nutrition up, he takes his nutrients every day, he's in good shape. Okay, so let's talk about methyl trapping. Methyl trapping happens when there's not enough B12 to recycle homocysteine to methionine. It very frequently happens when we have a shortage, or we have a problem with the shortcut, which is the BHMT. The methyl folate gets trapped. It can't go anywhere because we can't recycle over here. It requires a combination of LMTHF and the appropriate cobalamin. So if you're supplementing with the methyl folate, you've got to give them appropriate cobalamin. Now, for some folks, it's methyl cobalamin. For some folks, it's adenosyl. For some folks, it's hydroxy. And there's no like recipe for knowing who's going to respond to which. I tend to find that people who tend to have tendencies towards anxiety and also very tired, they need help with their Krebs cycle working better. The adenosyl B12 tends to be a good one to give. For others, hydroxy, and then just being careful with the methyl forms to make sure that they get what they need without overstepping the bounds there. Okay. Okay. So let's just finish, wrap up with the methylation by talking about how would you know if a person actually has some of these? So they may have the genes, but how do you know if the genes are expressing? So we could do blood markers. We can look at their homocysteine. If that's elevated, there's a good chance that they're deficient in the folate or the B12 or B6 or all of them. If they have high MCV, mean corpuscular volume, it could be a shortage of folate or B12. Methylmalonic acid, that's considered the gold standard in urine for B12 deficiency. You can also test folate and folate metabolites. There's a company called Vitamin Research, which will do the various metabolites of folate. So if you're suspicious that this may be happening and you want to know where the breakdown is happening or the blockage is happening, you can do serum B12, but I don't think serum B12 is the best approach. I think you're going to get much better indicator of the B12 if you do homocysteine, MCV, methylmalonic acid, especially methylmalonic acid. That's really clear. Okay, so we got through all this methylation stuff, and now we're going to get into the genes, and we're going to look at the genes related to food and then related to particular areas. So I want to look to see if there's any questions. If you have any questions, put them in the chat. Is everybody good? Just give me some feedback as to whether you're like over the top overwhelmed with this or if I'm going at a good pace. Let's see. Got a lot of you on. Good pace for Paula. Great. It's a lot, but good for Lynette. Yeah, it is a lot. I mean, ideally we would stop now and we'd come back and do the rest of this another day, but this is how we scheduled it. We said it was going to be a 2-hour deep dive and we're going to do it that way. All right. So that was the hard part. Now we're going to get into some of the more like, interesting stuff and ways that you can look at it. And we're just going to give you lots of access to different genes. So we want to get ideas of if a person's deficient in specific nutrients. There are particular genes that tend to be more closely related, like vitamin A, the BCMO1. That gene impacts the way that the beta carotene gets converted to vitamin A. And if the beta carotene is inefficiently converted, like somebody has a homozygous BCMO1, and there's three different genes that we look at for that. If they have three of them, if they have homozygous, we're going to tend to think that they have slowness of conversion there. Now, you can bypass this by giving them plenty of the beta carotene and hope that they get enough vitamin A. But one of the downsides of that is their skin will turn orange. I personally like that. I have BCMO1s to double heterozygous. And what I noticed when I first started changing my diet was that I started to get a nice little orangey yellow glow to my skin. I used to be very pale. And I wondered about that and I thought, well, I'm not eating a lot of carrot juice. People say, oh, you must drink a lot of carrot juice. But I wasn't drinking a lot of carrot juice. But all the other foods have a lot of beta carotene, right? So I, for insurance purposes, I take vitamin A maybe once a month. I do muscle testing and I do, you know, little sway testing and energetic testing to see if my body's wanting it at any point in time. And what it averages out to is maybe once or twice a month, I take some vitamin A, maybe in the form of 5,000. I took it every day for a while, but I think I, you know, replenished my stores for the years to come. Vitamin B6, there's a gene called NPBF3. And we'll look at ways that you can find some of these genes and find out whether you have them by looking at raw data in 23andMe and some of the reports. I haven't seen any of the reports showing the NPBF3. BCMO1 is in all of the reports. Vitamin B12 is impacted. We already talked about MTR and MTRR, but FUT2, which we'll go into much more detail on in the gut part, has to do with how well your body feeds your bifidobacter and how good your bifidobacter status might be. And it's involved in B12 as well. And there's others that are marginally involved with B12. Folate and B2 are related to the MTHFR. Vitamin C, there's one called SLC23A1. And then there's this intergenic that's related to vitamin E, and that's kind of a space between some of the genes. And that increases the vitamin E in the body. So you got to be careful if they have that, that you don't supplement too much, because too much vitamin E is fat soluble and it can be problematic. These are the ones, these are the SNPs I've found to be related to vitamin D, the VDR, which is the vitamin D receptor, and I have that on another slide to go into more detail. There's one called GC, and I've given the RSID because GC is kind of a little short shortcut, so it's easier to find it by the RSID. It encodes an enzyme that transports the D in blood into the cell. So this is important. You may be getting enough of it on the receptors, but not getting it into the cells. And then there's a few cytochrome P450s, and we're going to look at the cytochromes when we look at detox, because most of them are related to detox. But the CYP24A1 is related to maintaining calcium homeostasis, which is important for vitamin D. CYP27B1 encodes an enzyme that activates the vitamin D. And then the DHCR7 is a regulatory switch between cholesterol and vitamin D synthesis, because we know that vitamin D is synthesized from cholesterol. And then a GRCH38 is related to vitamin D binding. Now, are you going to memorize these? No. Do I have these memorized? No. But I know that there's stuff related to D. And if I'm looking at somebody who just keeps taking lots of D, but their D isn't going up, I'm looking to see, do they have any of these? And am I going to just have to let them know that you're probably going to be taking these high levels of D for your life? Now, with the receptor, the VDR is the receptor. There's a couple of different variations of it. And it can lead to lower and low normal D. So if you're working with somebody and they have a low D and you supplement like 10,000 IUs of D or 5,000, you go, it didn't work. It could be because of this receptor or because of any of the ones we just looked at. But the VDR FOK is also associated with blood sugar and poor pancreatic activity, which could have to do with also absorption of other nutrients because of the pancreatic enzymes being low. The VDR-TAQ SNPs combined with COM-T that we looked at before, catechol-O-methyltransferase, can lead to difficulty with handling methyl donors. So when they have that homozygous COM-T and they also have the VDR, you have to be extra careful about the problem that we talked about earlier with over too much methylation causing anxiety and hostility and all that. Okay, so that's that. Here's some of the B12 related genes. We already talked about MTR and MTRR. MTR increases your need for B12, and MTRR helps recycle B12. So if you're low in that, you're going to need more B12. And here's the genes again associated with folate metabolism. I showed you those before, but I wanted to reproduce it in the section related to nutrition because it's related to the nutrition. And you can have that. I would say print a lot of these off so you have them to use as you're going through and learning this and working with your own genes, your family's genes, and your client's genes. So there's genes related to fat metabolism. You may have already heard of the ApoE, 4 being a problem. So ApoE, apolipoprotein E. And, the 3 or 4 are problems. So 4, if they have a 4-4, they're going to be very sensitive to saturated fats, especially animal fats. So they got to keep their saturated fat intake really low, like 10% of the diet or less. The 3-4, they have a little bit more leniency. The ApoE gene, the ApoE4, increases the risk of Alzheimer's and increases the risk of cardiovascular disease. So it's really important to know the ApoE status, especially if someone is going, you know, is trying a high fat paleo diet or a keto diet and they have an ApoE4 and they're eating a ton of lard and other things like that, they can be creating a serious, serious problem with their cardiovascular system or accelerating their journey towards Alzheimer's. Okay. So ApoE, ApoA2, there's a CRT SNP that regulates the response after meal to saturated fat. So I can't remember which one's which, but one will have people be, you know, like really full and really satiated after a high saturated fat. PPAR-G, that has to do with the fat metabolism, but it's also related to diabetes. And APIPOQ is related to, it's called the adipose-specific gene. So all of these relate to how well the person handles fat. And when they have a lot of SNPs in this area, you just want to be really careful about finding the right macronutrient ratio for them. The ACAT, acetyl coenzyme A acetyltransferase, has to do with lipid metabolism and energy generation of energy. So in the mitochondria, it can deplete B12. So you've got to be really careful with this if they've got a SNP here and increase the likelihood of gut dysbiosis. So there's a bunch of others that are related to the gut. In fact, there's tons of them. Now, here's the thing. Like, certain people like certain food and other people don't. There are genes that are related to that. One I didn't put on here was the asparagus gene. I haven't been able to find what that exact gene is. But the bitter taster, TAS2R38, and two of those different RSIDs, that person is going to really taste bitter and they're not going to like it. So these are the people who you make this delicious salad and it's got some arugula in it and it's got a little dandelion and you're sitting there just, oh, you love it. They're like, oh, it's too bitter, right? Those are the people who need to put tons of stevia or fruit into a smoothie before they drink it. Those are people who just don't like the taste of bitter. The sweet taster have an enhanced sweet taste. So the TAS1R3. What that means is that the sweet taste especially appealing to them. And if you get a combination of a bitter taster and a sweet taster, those are the pickiest eaters, right? Because they don't like the bitter and they love the sweet. Then you have the salt sensitive. And in the salt sensitive people, the GNB3, NOS3, ACE, and AGT, they're going to be much more sensitive to salt, which could cause their blood pressure to go up. For the most part, you know, many people do not have a problem with salt unless they way overdo it. But some people are super salt sensitive, and those are the people that the recommendation to do a low salt diet for hypertension are important. We've got gluten intolerance, the HLA-DQ2.5 and the DQ8. We've got lacto intolerance with the MCM6. Alcohol intolerance, which ALDH2, aldehyde dehydrogenase, is the enzyme that breaks down alcohol. And when people don't have an appropriate amount of that enzyme, they don't break down the alcohol and it stays in their system longer. And those are the people that call themselves the cheap date, right? Just have a little bit of alcohol and they're woozy and stuff for hours. And then the metabolism breakdown of alcohol, CYPE21. So those are the eating-related genes. And then there's genes related to specific things people should be avoiding. We talked about the gluten. There's a few others. DQ2, DQ8, DQ1, DQ3, and DQ7. The dairy, we looked at lactose, but also these others, LCT, MCM6, FLG, and those are the RSIDs. People who have problems with yeast, and funguses, DEFB1, FUT2. And remember, FUT2 has to do with the probiotic, you know, how much bifidus they really need. I have that FUT2 gene. I have homozygous. There's probably 6 or 8 different variations of it. Mine are almost completely homozygous. And that explains for me, when I saw that, I was like, oh, that explains it, why I crave probiotic-containing foods. Why I don't just like one spoonful of sauerkraut. I want to eat the whole jar. Why when I have coconut kefir, I just want to drink the whole thing down. It's because my body is craving that because it needs it to replenish my organisms. People who have the FUT2 and the or the AMY1 gene tend to do better on NSCT GAPS or FODMAPs diet. Again, remember, those are temporary diets. Those are not diets you're going to put people on for the long haul. Low oxalates, so there's the CASR, the SPP1, AGXT, and then there's a particular locus on the GRHPR. So that means they're not breaking down oxalates the way they should, and they're going to be sensitive to that. They may be sensitive to getting oxalate crystals build up in their kidneys, in their bladder, in their vulva, in the eyes, in the joints. So those are people who you want to be careful and slowly reduce the oxalates and then find their happy zone of where they do best. Salicylates. We talked about some of these different diets at Shine, but the MTHFR will, you know, tend to make people a little bit more sensitive to the salicylates in food, as with the CYP2C9 and the UTG1A6. Okay. And low phenol diet. Like, if they're not handling phenols real well, the salt 1A1, these are both sulfur containing, right? Salt 1A1 and 1A2. People who tend to need to do more of a low histamine diet, people who have the DAO, diamine oxidase, and then the HNMT NAT2, which has also to do with a lot of different drugs, MTHFR, MAO, and PEMT. So if you see a combination of, you know, two, three or more of those, you might be checking out to see if they're histamine sensitive. And then low sulfur diet, CBS and SULT. You're going to see a lot of stuff out there on CBS, which talks about how, you know, you should address that first. Amy Yasko talks about that. I think most people have found that that's not necessarily the case. She also talks about doing super low sulfur foods, and I've seen people try that and not do well with it. So the CBS, it just depends on whether it's activated or not. And when you get people on a super low sulfur diet and they don't need it, you're avoiding like some of the best foods there are for detoxification, you know, your cruciferous vegetables, garlic, your onions. So if the person has trouble with those, then yeah, the low sulfur diet will be necessary while you're working on healing their gut. And then, you know, the people with the high histamine, the DAO and HNMT are the most important ones. The histamines are broken down by the DAO and by the HNMT. So if they have a SNP here and they're going to be not breaking them down efficiently, then they're going to have problems with some of these high histamine foods, the aged foods, the spoiled foods, the leftovers. Who wants to eat spoiled foods? But some people unknowingly do. Some people can't eat the leftovers because of the buildup of the histamines. Alcohol, fish, pickled foods, canned foods, aged cheeses, smoked meats, shellfish, beans, walnuts and cashews, cocoa, citrus, wheat, and vinegar. So if you find that you have somebody who's sensitive to a lot of these foods, they may have a histamine problem. Now you can get a DAO enzyme to break it down, but I haven't found a clean source of it. They usually have talc and a bunch of other additives to them, so I'm a little hesitant there. I find that vitamin C in high doses and quercetin also help to bring those down. So you can work with people on that. Quercetin is in onions. So as long as they don't have an ulcer and sulfur problem, onions can be a good thing to do. All right. So that's it for the food. Let's look at blood sugar. Now this is there's a lot of data in here. I remember doing this research. I couldn't stop because I have such blood sugar issues, and then looking up most of mine. I didn't look up every single one of these to see if I had them, but I had a lot of them. I really did have a lot of them, which explains why I have to be super careful with my blood sugar. And I can maintain perfect blood sugar. Yesterday I was in the 70s and 80s, no problem, because I'm taking care of it. And you just have to find out who those people are that need to be super careful. So let's look at blood sugar. So I'm going to give you a list of SNPs. I've got pages and pages and pages of this. Then I have a summary chart at the end. Then I have even more resources where you can find even more of these. So again, I'm not going to just read all these slides. You're not going to memorize these. I just want to tell you a little few highlights about each of these, and then you'll have your chart and you'll be able to look these up for people and for yourself to see how strict you need to be, or to at least give you the mental clarity around why you have to be so bloody strict about your blood sugar. This one is MC4R, pancreatic neuronal melanocortin 4. And with people with this one, you're going to see much higher blood sugar levels and usually associated with obesity. It has to do with leptin, and it modulates the serum levels of insulin. And I'm giving you links in all of these if you want to go further with this. And most of these have links on them. IGF-1R, insulin-like growth factor 1, the receptor to it. And it's the insulin-like growth factor has a very similar property, molecular structure as insulin does. And then there's receptors. There's a tyrosine kinase receptor that signals by causing a phosphate module and to particular tyrosines. So again, we could be here for 4 hours just doing this. And in fact, in our blood sugar program, for those of you who are in IRSPT, we did a very detailed presentation that went from maybe an hour and a half just on the blood sugar one. So I don't want to spend an hour and a half just on this. I just want to make you aware of all the ones that are here, and then we'll move on to some of the other areas. And each one has a link, or most of them do anyway. Okay, so this shows you the receptors that are problematic with it. The IRS1, insulin receptor substrate 1, codes for the protein. This one is associated with susceptibility to non-insulin dependent diabetes, which is a type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance, versus some of them are more prone towards the insulin dependent and related to the pancreas. MTRR is related to blood sugar. So that's my other double whammy. I have the MTRR. I have homozygous on the MTRR. So has to do with my B12, has to do with my blood sugar. And it's associated with metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance, especially when combined with MTHFR. Whoops, there's a typo there. C677T. Okay, so I've got it all. I've got the MTRR, I've got the MTHFR, plus I've got a whole bunch of other insulin problems. MTHFR677T, associated with metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance. There's controversy over it, but it definitely is been reported. All right. FTO, fat mass and obesity associated protein. And this one has to do with when people don't feel satiated after they eat. They've eaten plenty, but they don't feel satiated. And a lot of people are like that. They have that starving for something more after they finish a meal. And it reduces insulin sensitivity. LPR is the leptin receptor gene, and it's associated with increased snacking behavior and insulin resistance. The SLC2A2, solute carrier family member 2, very interesting name, right? And it codes for the sugar transporter receptor, GLUT2, and on each cell, the GLUT2 receptor is there to accept the glucose combination with insulin. So, and this is actually called the sweet tooth gene. When people have this, they tend to eat more sugar because they don't turn it off. The sugar can't get into the cells, so they crave it more. Glucose transporter 2, just did that one, ABCC8, ATP binding cassette transporter, subfamily C, member 8. You can see I got really into the research for this stuff. The receptor, the sulfonylurea receptor, helps to regulate insulin. So this particular one can result in the failure of the insulin to be released from the beta cells. So this one's more associated with a type 1 diabetes than a type 2. GCGR is a glucagon receptor. Now remember, glucagon is the antagonist of insulin, right? Insulin helps to decrease the blood sugar by getting the sugar into the cells. Glucagon goes to find stored sugar in the form of glycogen, put it back into the bloodstream. Okay, so this, a defect here is associated with type 2 diabetes because they just can't keep the blood sugars elevated enough. So hypoglycemia, reactive hypoglycemia might be more problematic here. The PPARG, peroxisome proliferator activator receptor gamma, has to regulate the adipocytes, which are fat cells, right? And it's identified as a mediator for the maintenance of whole body insulin sensitivity. So the SNP is associated with decreased insulin sensitivity and the weight gain that happens, the PPARG gamma. LIPC is lipase C, hepatic type, hepatic meaning liver, right? And it affects insulin sensitivity in response to exercise. So we know how we say, you know, if you exercise, you become much more insulin sensitive. And there are people who say, well, I exercise and my blood sugar goes up. What's going on there? It's possible that they have this SNP and their body's just not sensitive to that. Transcription factor 7-like-2, TCF7L2, influences transcription. And it's very important for insulin secretion and glucose production. When we have too much TCF7L2, it stimulates insulin to be secreted, more insulin to be secreted by the beta cells in the pancreas. And it's associated with type 2 diabetes, also with gestational diabetes. So if you have people who are pregnant, they say, every time I get pregnant, I get gestational diabetes. They may have that gene. So ADIPOQ is adiponectin, C1Q, and collagen domain containing. It's expressed by adipose tissue, the fat tissue, and it's associated with adiponectin deficiency. Adiponectin helps the muscles pick up the glucose. So what happens when we have adiponectin deficiency is the glucose can't effectively bring up the glucose into the muscles, and we end up with increased sugar and decreased appetite, because the adiponectin will help to decrease the sugar levels and decrease appetite. So people are running around hungry all the time. And visceral fat accumulation has been associated with this particular SNP also. Let's see, AKT2 serine threonine protein kinase, it doesn't refer to its function. So that was clear in the articles. It's like, that's kind of crazy. But this is related to severe insulin resistance in diabetes because it has to do with the transport of glucose. Calpain 10 is a family of calcium-dependent cysteine proteases, and it's associated with type 2 diabetes risk, especially in Mexican Americans. Let's see. Why is that stuff on there? Looks like there's little dots on there. I'm going to try to do the eraser. There we go. All right. So these are some additional ones, as if what we just gave you wasn't enough. These I just didn't do all the research on. It takes hours and hours and hours to do this. But these are others that can be looked up. There's a Snipedia article on it. And where you can go deeper is this other whole article that goes into the carbohydrates and the diabetes and all that. And then I have a chart which summarizes all those SNPs that we went over. So you can have them on one sheet with the little Cliff Notes version. This is something I found that talked about all these others. So relating them to how they impact blood sugar balance. So these are related to insulin resistance. These are related to abdominal obesity. These are related to inflammation. And the link again is there. These are related to triglycerides, a lot related to triglycerides. And we know that the triglyceride HDL ratio is an important monitor of whether somebody's insulin resistant. We should see it somewhere around 1:1, equal triglycerides and HDLs. And the higher we get a disparity between them, the higher the triglycerides or the lower the HDL gets, the more the chance of insulin resistance. Is it 100%? Marker? No, it's not, but it is definitely there. Here's the HDL. These are all related to HDL. Okay, and then there's some additional resources for you to look it up. If this wasn't enough and you really want to get into it, if you want to specialize in this, or you're looking at it for family members and you want to learn more, it's a way to do that. Okay, any questions there so far? Let's see if there's any. So Lynn says there's a gene where they don't like chocolate. I don't know about that one. Find that one for me. I'd like to know about that one. I don't have that one. Let's see. And Martha's correct. It takes a while to learn this and it's repetition. Let's see. Yep. Texture sensitivity SNP. I'm sure there is. I mean, I would just look some of that stuff up. Snipedia or GeneWise are good places to look. Lynette's talking about palate results, which matches foods and nutrients to my SNP. Super fascinating. I'd love to see that, Lynette. Maybe we can do that on a call, on an NEPT call. All right. Okay, so we're ready to move on, right? Is this pace okay? Let's see, where are we at? Slide 93 of 150. So we're more than halfway there. Hopefully we're almost at the end of our time. So let's talk about genetics and some general hormone balance. We know that there's very specific ones. COMT is very important in relationship to breast cancer. I thought I'd give you a list of breast cancer risk SNPs. So the TNF, the CYP1B1, CYP1A1, COMT, NQ01, and homozygous. That one is, homozygous is just a 4% activity increase. Okay, so the relative risk of getting breast cancer when you have these is increased dramatically with obesity, smoking, alcohol, total years of estrogen exposure. So someone who's been on the pill a lot is going to have a problem there. Polycystic or aromatic hydrocarbons. So that's your exhaust fumes, your charbroiled steak, fried, broiled, and well done meat. Okay. And there's some good articles there that you can look this up further with. But, you know, people always talk about the BRCA gene when it's related to breast cancer, and that has a very high, affinity to breast cancer, but there are others as well. And guess what? You can change that. Remember the 95-5, right? You have that gene. You just have to be extra more careful about what you do so that you don't manifest it. Stay lean. Don't smoke. Stay away from alcohol. Don't take birth control pills. So this is one of my favorite estrogen metabolism charts. I show it in a lot of my classes. And it basically shows how the estrogens get formed. Androstenedione is a male hormone. It's a downstream metabolite of testosterone. So testosterone gets converted into estrogen. As men age, they will find that they have an increase of an enzyme called aromatase, which will cause more of their testosterone to get converted with estrone. That's not a good thing to happen to postmenopausal, if you want, andropausal men, but it's common. So this shows the different metabolites. Estrone, estradiol, and estriol are our major estrogens, E1, E2, and E3. And then there's these metabolites. 4-hydroxy, 4-OH, estrone, is a very dangerous metabolite, increases the risk of breast cancer. So it's aggravated when we have low magnesium, but also when we're exposed to any of these qualities here that, the pesticides, the alcohol, the high-fat diet, and lack of these nutrients are going to cause us to go down this pathway, because we can't go down the pathway to 2-hydroxy. 2-hydroxy is the safer, and then 2-methoxy is the protective. But if we don't have enough methylation activity going on, we're not going to convert down here. You'd see that we need good nutrients, and we need avoidance of a lot of these factors. The 16 is an in-betweeny, right? It's not as bad as the 4-OH, but it's not as protective as the 2. And again, if their person has, they're obese, they have hypothyroid, pesticides, cimetidine, which is an ulcer type of medication or a reflux type medication, they will end up with more of the 16. It's a dangerous metabolite, but with the presence of enough iodine, it gets converted down to estriol, which is protective. Now, what does all this mean? We're not going to spend too much time going into all this science of this, but the reason I showed this is because I want to show you the next chart, which shows you some of the SNPs that enter into those pathways. Okay? So you have estradiol, which was here. Estradiol here, right? The estradiol when if you've got the CYP1A1, remember that first picture I showed you that was on there, 1B1, 1A1 or 1B1. If we have significant, if we're good in the 1A1, it's going to be fine and we're going to go down the 2. But if we have a problem with the 1A1 and we don't make enough of it, or if you have an overactive 1B1, we're going to go down the 4 pathway, and that's going to be a problem. The COM-T is another one, okay? The COM-T is going to help us go from the 2-hydroxy to the 2-methoxy. The 4, the COM-T in good status is also going to help us go down to the 4-methoxy, which is going to neutralize and make that safer. So this is just something you can go to the article and read more, but I wanted to show you that these gene pathways have to do with a lot with the conversions, but also all of these lifestyle factors are super important. These are the epigenetic environmental factors that can be used to push these down the healthy pathways. Okay. The thyroid is related to methylation and gene interaction. Like gluten intolerance contributes to thyroid peroxidase antibodies in Hashimoto's, and there's a specific gene related to that, the CTLA4. So people have that tendency, they will tend to be more likely to have Hashimoto's, and it's super, super important that they watch the gluten. And if they have a gluten problem with the CTLA, like if they have one of those DQs, even more so. But I believe that anybody that has Hashimoto's or any kind of autoimmune needs to start with getting off of gluten. A vitamin A deficiency if they have a BCMA1 and increased homocysteine, which they'd have if they have an MTHFR issue or MTR, that contributes to thyroid receptor resistance. And we see this a lot. Okay, we don't have time to go into all the details on that, but thyroid receptor resistance is one of the most common cause of hypothyroid symptoms. The lab tests will look perfectly normal if all they have is the resistance, but these things affect, and this is how the genes affect the expression of thyroid, vitamin A deficiency, and the MTHFR affects it, okay, with the homocysteine aggravation. MTHFR impacts vitamin B2, which is needed for the conversion of iodine and tyrosine, the synthesis of T4. And then other nutrients, selenium, iron, zinc, B12, magnesium, and D3 are all needed for healthy thyroid. And we talked about places in the genetics that are impacted there. Okay, so we definitely would be looking at how would somebody be genetically prone to thyroid. Okay, there's also a CTLA. Yeah, CTLA is the one. This is a little bit complicated, but I just wanted you to see how entwined the thyroid and the adrenals are with the MTHFR and then the neurotransmitters, which is the BH4 cycle. Okay, so T4 will regulate the conversion of riboflavin to FAD, which is an important cofactor that helps stabilize the MTHFR. When we don't have enough T4 or the B12, two levels are deficient, that can be reducing and decrease FAD, which is going to impair the Krebs cycle, and that's going to lead to decreased MTHFR activity, which is going to decrease the BH4 activity, which is going to decrease the tyrosine. Okay, so here's the connection, guys. Tyrosine is an important neurotransmitter. It's important for neurotransmitter for making dopamine, but it's also important for making thyroid hormone. The heart of the thyroid molecule is tyrosine. Tyrosine and some number of iodine, 3 for T3, 4 for T4. So the tyrosine is also used to make dopamine. It's also used to make norepinephrine and epinephrine, which are adrenals. So we have a tyrosine that can be reduced and then have problems with the adrenal. So it's like this cycle that you just have to kind of wind your way down to try to figure out when we're trying to get to what root cause. Okay. So I'll let you, have that pictorially to study while we move on to digestion. All right. I've got three that are related to digestion, three pages, part one, part two, and part three. And some of these are some ones that we've looked at already, like the MC4R regulates energy balance, that was involved in blood sugar. COMT, which is involved in estrogen and neurotransmitter involvement, can cause IBS because it can cause the body to have too much dopamine because we're not breaking it down. CYP27B1 affects vitamin D. What does vitamin D have to do with the gut? Everything. We need it to repair and keep the membrane working. Otherwise, we have leaky gut. We can't heal a leaky gut if the vitamin D levels aren't there. DHCR7 related to the vitamin D. So a lot of these we're just repeating. We're coming back to MTHFR has to do with the folate metabolism. Very important for gut repair and methylation. The HLA, DQ2 and 8. Have to do with celiac or gluten sensitivity risk. We've got another one, ATG16L1, which would increase the risk of Crohn's disease and IBS. The APOA4, as opposed to the E4, has a role in lipid metabolism in the intestines. FUT2, we talked about earlier, it's the body's ability to secrete the blood type antigens, the ABO antigens, into the body fluids like saliva, sweat, tears, and the gut. When we don't secrete those fluids in the gut, especially, we don't feed our bifidobacter. So we have to be able to constantly be replenishing that through food. The positive side of FUT2, I can be happy for. I'm going to be more resistant to H. pylori and rotavirus, but a higher risk of Crohn's. DAO we talked about for histamine breakdown. You know, you have people who eat and then they get red. DAO. ACE regulates fluid balance, also blood pressure. And that was related to salt metabolism, if you recall a couple of slides ago. GIF is involved in the formation of intrinsic factor by the parietal cells of the stomach. What's that for? B12 absorption, right? So if you get somebody with the GIF, you get somebody with that plus the FUT2 plus MTRR and MTR, then you know, B12 sublingual shots topically, you know, get the B12 in because there's some impairments there. PEMT has to do with phospholipids. We already talked earlier about how phospholipids were super important for methylation. So this is phosphatidylethanolamine methyltransferase. So remember the methyl, right? PEMT. And it's involved in the conversion of ethanolamine, phospholipid, into phosphatidylcholine, which is part of the cellular membrane in the gut, but it's also important for memory function. It's a precursor to acetylcholine, which is a neurotransmitter for memory function. Oops, there is part two. That was just part one. I put the taste genes in here because that affects the FTO, the satiation gene. How much effort will you put out to obtain food? In the olden days, that mattered, right? When you had to go hunt things down. Nowadays, it's just, are you willing to drive to the store or walk to the kitchen? SHMT has to do with purine synthesis, and mutations can have to do with gut pathogens and iron absorption. So that's an important one. What else ones? The NPBF, risk of B6 deficiency. We've looked at a lot of these. The vitamin C has to do with and increases the risk of gastric cancer and IBD. The MAO, that's neurotransmitter, right? Monoamine oxidase, but it also affects the dopamine and norepinephrine and serotonin. Those are important in, guess what, the gut. So deficiencies of serotonin and dopamine in the gut will lead to sluggishness of the bowel, and excess will lead to hyperirritable bowel. GAD, involved in the conversion of glutamate to GABA. GAD is a super important one. And when we look at neurotransmitters, we look at, in addition to the COMT, the MAO, the GAD is super important because the body can't effectively convert glutamate, which is excitatory, to GABA, which is calming. So these people, you do have to be careful with the GADs to make sure that they can handle if you're trying to give them glutamine for leaky gut, right? So sometimes they do fine with it, but sometimes they don't. So I go really slowly. And if they say, well, ever since I started taking that glutamine, I'm all excited and irritable, I can't sleep. Oops, let's not do it. Okay. LRRK2 is linked to increased risk of Parkinson's. And what we're finding is that Parkinson's is linked to constipation. And some people, the early sign of Parkinson's is chronic constipation. So you want to keep that in mind when you're working with people with chronic gut stuff. IgA is the immune protection, the immunoglobulin A, that's lining the gut. So that's really important. When if they have problems with making enough of it because of a genetic abnormality, they're going to have low immunity in the gut. And then the TAS2 is eating disinhibition. So like, it's the turn off. It's like telling you when to stop. SNPs related to digestion. Those of you who are in CMDS, we did a long presentation on just the genetics, and it's one of the bonus modules in CMDS, our clinical mastery of the digestive system. Those of you in NEPT get all of this. We have CYP2E1 related to alcohol, APOA1. We talked about that after meal response to saturated fat. Oh, here it is. The C variant, the saturated fats will make you fat. The T variants, the saturated fat won't. So some people, they can eat all this fat and they don't gain weight, and other people do. Has to do with that, or it could have to do with that. The GSM related to late onset Alzheimer's disease. I'm not sure why that was in there. APOE, the ability to saturate, to do the saturated fat. The CYP2C19 increases the risk of GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disorder. CCL26, also reflux. So if you have somebody who has this chronic reflux and you're having trouble with doing your DGL and other kind of protocols and not getting well, they may have a genetic tendency, and you just have to be more patient and spend more time and be more diligent in working with them. Gallstones, here's one, ADRB3. I'd be curious to see if the folks that have had their gallbladder removed have that problem, that gene. Whether it's hetero or homozygous. There's the MCM6 for lactose intolerance, the GC we talked about before, the transporting vitamin D, the VDR. We talked about that earlier. FADS1, risk of decreased omega 3 and 6. So, you know, if you're having issues with that, they may have to be focused more on getting extra of the omegas in their diet. Finally, we have interferon regulatory factor, which is antiviral cytokines. So cytokines being these inflammatory chemicals. And so when somebody has an IRF5, they may have irritable bowel. Sometimes they have scleroderma. All right. And then we have our FUT2. We've talked a lot about this. I just want to a few points, and I gave you some references there so you can look them up. The non-secretors don't secrete their blood type. 20% of Europeans and Africans are homozygous. I am of European descent, and I'm homozygous, so I'm in that 20%. Involved in the formation of immune complex known as an H antigen. Now, the good part is that we're resistant to most strains of norovirus. The bad part, and also H. pylori, but the bad part is we can find that we can have problems with B12. There were some mixed studies on it that some had better absorption of B12, some had less. It's also the oligosaccharides which become food for the gut flora. So that's basically it. So I don't have enough of these oligosaccharides being created from my blood antigens to feed the bifido. So I have to make sure I get plenty of it. Okay. SHMT, serine hydroxymethyltransferase, lipid metabolism and energy regeneration. So it can deplete vitamin B12 and increase the likelihood of gut dysbiosis and gut flora imbalance. And it can retain metals like aluminum. So that can be problematic, especially if somebody's had some immunizations, the flu shot, whatever, which contain that aluminum. Then there's many of these we've already looked at. I don't want to go through all of them. I think most of them we have, but I've just categorized them as related to the gut-brain interaction. So you see them. I've always been this person who likes to categorize things. So I always make lots of charts so I can see things in different ways, and that's what helps it go into my brain. So if this helps you to see them in different places and to read through them, then by all means, you know, make use of it. But we've gone through all of these already. Okay. Whew, we're getting close. Sulfur metabolism. Sulfur metabolism is that bottom part of the cycle where we go from homocysteine down to glutathione and then out to cysteine and sulfites and sulfates. Okay. Now, the sulfur problems, when we have, okay, how am I going to explain this? So the problem here is that when we have too much of the ammonia, when we are creating too much ammonia via that sulfur pathway, that's going to create a problem with oxidative stress and inflammation. And it's going to affect and impact that BH4, which is going to produce the various neurotransmitters. So you can see these pathways, the phenylalanine to tyrosine, and then we have a tyrosine to L-DOPA. We have tryptophan to 5-HTP and arginine to nitric oxide. And this is all really important. And this whole cycle is this acetylmethionine, the SAMe. Okay. All right. So CBS. Cystathione beta synthase. That's what's going to take that homocysteine and convert it down to cystathionine, which then eventually gets converted down into glutathione. When this SNP is activated, it's possible to have high levels of taurine and ammonia, and those could be measured on an amino acid test. The first step in the transfer, yes, so we talked about that. All right, so CBS and transsulfation. So let's go back to this pretty picture by my whatever distant relative. Who knows? Maybe he is my relative. I'll have to look him up. Anyway, so we've got this whole the cycle up at the top, which is the B12 folate, the two cycles, down to the homocysteine. So the homocysteine can be recycled up to methionine or down, and it's actually both. Comes down to cystathionine. We absolutely need our vitamin B6. Okay. And then once it gets to cysteine, which is an amino acid, it gets converted to another form of cysteine and then to glutathione. Can also go from cysteine down to brain hydrogen sulfide. And it can go from the cysteine down to vascular hydrogen sulfide. Hydrogen sulfide is going to increase the oxidative stress and decrease the effectiveness of various pathways, okay? So what does this mean? It means that if we take too much glutathione, then we have a backup, And the backup, that cysteine can't get converted to glutathione because we already are taking it, and it can affect the brain and the vascular system through this hydrogen sulfide. So it's just reinforcing for you the importance of not over supplementing people. If good, if some is good, more is better. And knowing when to stop. Sometimes people need glutathione for a short period of time, and then we back it off and just make sure that we're getting it through food. Avocado is a good source, or other sources of cysteine in the diet that can be converted down there. But if a person is problematic in this CGL SNP, then they're going to need more. There's also a glutathione GTX. We'll look at that in a minute. That can cause a problem there too. We'll look at that when we do detox. Okay, detox, yay. We're getting there. We know the liver is the seat of most detox. All organs do, though. We have the lining of the gut that has some of these liver detox enzymes. There's a set of enzymes called the cytochrome P450 that will help to break down the toxins. So it's really important that we have good functioning of the kidney and the gallbladder, liver, and the gut in order to do detox. So here are the major detox SNPs. A lot of these are reported on the genetic genie test, which I'll show you in a bit. We have the CYP1A1, 1A2. We talked about these earlier when we talked about the hydrocarbons, the 1A2. We talked about caffeine and estrogen metabolism. And it upregulates, when they have this SNP, it will upregulate the 4-hydroxylation of estrogen, which, remember, was the dangerous one. The 2A6 detoxifies the nitrosamines, which is in a lot of that processed meat, and nicotine. The 2C9, drug metabolism. So there's a list of these. And you can go in here for the full list to Wikipedia or Snipedia, and you can look these up. But like this one, C19 detoxifies Coumadin. So what do you use these for? Okay, so if somebody has these SNPs and they are having trouble with the metabolism, the breakdown of these drugs, means these drugs can have much more adverse side effects. And so you want people to know this. Like, here it is. 25% of all prescription drugs on the 2D6, including tricyclics, MAO inhibitors, SSRIs, opiates, antiarrhythmics, beta blockers, cimetidine, these are common drugs, right? And so if people are giving these by a doctor who doesn't know that they have genetically impaired ability to break them down, then they may have some adverse side effects. And so it's important for the people to know this. So if they ever do, you know, have to break down and go on a drug, we try to keep people off medications, right? We try to get them to do things naturally. But they do, it'd be nice for them to know what these drugs are so that they don't take the drugs that are going to cause the most problems. CYP450, it's an enzyme that downregulations. Okay, so the 450 is impacted by glyphosate. Okay, so glyphosate, Roundup. We have all this Roundup ready food with the GMOs, and it's been linked to Parkinson's, autism, cancer, infertility, allergies. It's also in gut dysbiosis. It's very, very problematic. So, it affects and it suppresses these CYP enzymes. So it impacts your body's ability to detoxify. So when we look at this and we see any of these CYP450, down regulations, we would say, look, no GMO food, no GMO food. Here's some more detox SNPs. The 2E2, alcohol, acetone. So people are putting the nail polish on their fingers and then taking it off with acetone. Not so good, right? Benzene, carbon tetrahydrochloride. These are all common in the environment. C3A4, 60% of all known drugs. So we had this one here, which was the 2D6 was 25% of all drugs. The C3A4 is 60%. And it has to do with when we get these things impaired, we have problems with estrogen, testosterone, cortisol, steroids, organophosphates. So we got to be careful. In vitro, that's in the test tube. Milk thistle seems to inhibit this. So some people have to be really careful. So does grapefruit juice. So if somebody has a problem, they say, every time I take milk thistle, I feel weird. Don't make them take milk thistle. Don't say, oh yeah, but milk thistle's good for your liver. You need it. No, don't. Okay. The GSTP1 is a glutathionase transferase enzyme. So when they have a GSTP1, and if they have homozygous especially, they're going to be sluggish at making enough of the glutathione. So they may need to be taking more of the glutathione or of the precursors, you know, looking for high cysteine foods. SOD, superoxide dismutase, that and SOD, that and glutathione are the major detox SNPs. So we really need to be looking if somebody has a SNP here and if they have a homozygous, that we want to look at how do we get them to get more SOD. I've seen SOD creams and I've recommended that so they bypass the digestive tract. The NAT1 and the NAT2 have to do with environmental toxins and more drugs, the heterocyclic amines, cigarette smoke, etc. So when we have this, we want to make sure that they're protecting themselves, and cruciferous vegetables, garlic, onions, all that stuff is actually good. So you guys are having these conversations. Are you listening or are you just having conversations? I'm looking to see if there's any questions. I see Lynn pumping out information. Janet says, this is good. Jay says, it's good stuff. Lynette says, a lot of good. It takes a lot to learn. Repetition. Yep, you're right. Too bad there is not a gene to have an aversion to Oreo cookies and fast food. That's called your conscience. And that's called your self-love. Your self-love. Okay. Let's see. Okay. FUT2 could be a factor in dry eyes. That's a good point. Yeah, I think so. Anything to do to support tearing or tears? I wonder if there are any bifido type eye lubricants that would support that. Definitely, that's a good point. Everybody breathe. I'm almost at the end and I'm trying to finish up so I can get to my next meeting. Yeah, so Janine, there you go. So you can't take those meds. It's probably because you've got some of these, and all the better. It's great when you find out you can't take the meds because then it gives you some other way to look at it. Okay, great. Okay, good. Okay, good. Lynn found some drops, so I'm curious about that. Great. All right, so we got through the detox SNPs. I just wanted a pictorial have you see it, right? So these important ones, the 1A2 and the 1A2 for caffeine, the 1B1 for caffeine and estrogen. So these are all related to caffeine and estrogen. So these are important ones to know. And if a person has a bunch of these, that you're going to really have to work at helping them to protect their breasts and protect their estrogen metabolism. Here's another picture. It just is a nice little, you know, I just really like this picture, and it shows you the various the drugs that are metabolized and the percentage of the drugs and which ones. So this is kind of cool. All right, take a breath. Now we're going to get into how do we test this. I mean, there's lots more we could do, right? I could talk for days. I've been to Ben Lynch's web seminars and he talks for days about this stuff. But these are what I felt were the most important ones to get you started with to go deep. So genetic testing, we've got 23andMe, Pathway Fit, Holistic Health, Genova, SpectraCell. I personally just have people do the 23andMe. Interpretation, geneticgenie.org. Basically what you do is you download your raw data, I'll show you some slides on that in a bit, from 23andMe, and they have free reports. They ask for a $5 donation if you want to. MTHFRsupport.com, they will run a report. It's about a 50-page report. It has some little places on it, on the report that's online, that you can actually click and watch videos. Not a lot, but it does have some good stuff there. It's about $35. Prometheus is about $5. I'm not crazy about it. They just sent me an email and said, hey, we just, for the next couple of weeks, you can upgrade your thing and, you know, you don't have to pay again and you can get the latest report. But it's not that easy to read, but it's definitely worth the $5 if you want to run it through. LiveWello, again, I found them both very, you know, confusing to read. Love metabolichealing.com and I love Stratagene, and I'll show you some samples of those. So you want to research any of these genes. Snipedia is a great place to go. You'd look up the gene. I started to, when I was pulling all this together, started to put all the RSIDs in it, and it was going to take me another 5 hours. I mean, literally from the time it took to look up every single one and all the RSIDs, so I didn't. But this is what you get when you look there. You can look it up by RSID. The RSIDs can be found in the 23andMe database, and I'll show you that in a minute. There's a lot of interactions, right? So the raw data has over 900,000 SNPs. Genetic Genie and Yasco do about 30, 35. MTHFR support and LiveWello do about 300. And Stratagene do several dozen. So there's still a lot of them that we learn about, but they're not really reporting on, just because there's no clinical significance, right? Ben Lynch, who does Stratagene, said that he picked the ones that were clinically relevant. There are also some that are, and related to methylation. There are also some that are not. Of right now, my favorite tends to be the metabolic healing. It's about a 49-page report, and they have little descriptions of it. It looks like they got tired as they got to the end, because the beginning they have a lot of great descriptions, and towards the end they don't, but here you go. This is what the new 23andMe, you log in. This is what it looks like. You see I logged in as myself, and what you do is you click on Tools, and one of the drop-downs, it's going to say Raw Data. When you click Raw Data, you're going to get here. It's going to ask you, you know, when you're up, is this when you're uploading it? Yeah, when you're uploading your raw data, you have to sign away that your life, that you're agreeing. So if you want to download the raw data file, not upload, download. And then when you get in and you look at raw data, you are going to be able to browse it or download it. Now browsing it, you can look up any gene right here. You just type it in, like here I did MTHFR, and it shows you all the different MTHFRs and what is there. But my problem with this is it always says the variants, C or T, A or G, but it doesn't tell you what's the wild type or what's right or what's wrong, basically. So I don't know if I have a C, so like here, A or G, I have an AA. Does that mean that I'm homozygous for that, or does that mean that I'm normal for that? So that's where there must be some other way to read this that, you know, us normal folks don't do that the computers do, because they somehow figure that out. And it's hard to find that. Well, what is the normal? And it's a very time-consuming and tedious process. That's why I rely on the reports, and I'm very willing to pay to get those reports done. So this is the two that you can run. Well, there's several, but the Genetic Genie and MTHFR support I'm going to show you. This is from the MTHFR support. It's got a lot. You can see a lot of BHMTs, a lot of MTRRs, a lot. So it's giving you some that may not be clinically significant. This is what the report will look like. So you can see from me, I have this CYP2, C9. I've got a homozygous. I've got a couple of heterozygouses. So if I want to know what those are, I would just look those up on the charts that I provided you, and you'll know what's going on with you there. Okay, I'm really happy with my GSTM1, but then I have M3 where it's homozygous. Now, just because you see a lot of red doesn't mean it's a problem, because some of these we don't even know yet, right? We don't know. This is the Genetic Genie version of just the detox panel, and this is how many they give you. It's probably, you know, 20 of them. Okay, so I've got a few, like the 1B1, so I've got to watch the breast cancer. I got to make sure I'm doing plenty of cruciferous and staying away from caffeine and smoke and all that. And that's what my report looks like. So you can see the green is minus minus, green is wild type or normal, red is plus plus, and that's the homozygous, and yellow is the heterozygous. And there's the methylation from Genetic Genie. Like I said, these are free. You can do a $5 donation if you want to. And then Stratagene. Let's look at Stratagene. Stratagene gives you this nice chart. See, it's prepared for. They always tell you not put your real name in, so I just put in my initials. And it tells you where you have some of your backups. And it will tell you some things that will increase it and some things that will decrease it. So you get to kind of get, it's harder to read, but so you look at it, wild type, right? It's green. If yours is green, if yours is hetero, they have the dotted yellow and they have the dotted red. Then they show you what's the cofactor for that particular enzymatic reaction. And if it's like B6, you go, oh, okay, B6, I've got a problem here. Maybe I need to have extra B6. It'll tell you what increases the activity of that enzyme or it decreases the activity of it throughout the report. So this is the list. They do give you a chart so you can quickly look and see what your heteros and what your homozygous ones are. You can, this is what they call the bonus SNPs. So they don't do a lot of SNPs. They do these. And then they do the bonus SNPs and you can see the BCO1, which is the vitamin A, the ApoE. I'm a two, the way this is reading, I'm basically, I've looked at it on other places. I'm a 2-3. And then it shows you the folate cycle. So it shows you each of the cycles. So I have heterozygous SNPs here. And it shows me what's going to increase and what's going to decrease that. What things should I focus on helping to support me with that? And then it gives you some descriptions. So it talks about the MTRR and talks about the different things. So it's a really nice report. Metabolic healing goes in sections by body function. So it has the GI genetics, it lists them, and then it goes ahead and teaches you about what that's about, what they do. Like I said, some really good descriptions at the beginning, and then some squeamish ones. So they have GI health, it's a 49-page report. GI health, they have immune system, they have skin, they have eyes, they have cardiovascular clotting, sulfur metabolism, gut, brain, etc. And it's a really nice little report. Okay? So that's the reports. That's how you can get this information. You get it tested. You get it into a database. And then you run it through reports. But don't just jump in and think, okay, I've got this SNP for that supplement. I hear that all the time. Dr. Ben Lynch runs Seeking Health. So he could easily get into the mode of running the report and saying, get this supplement or that. There are a number of companies out there that do that. He doesn't feel like it's ethical because what he feels like I do, is you've got to address the foundations. You've got to get this person optimally healthy. You want to address the body freedom foundations, the sleep, the stress management, the outlook, the fun, exercise, rest, diet, etc. Remove all the folic acid, heal the gut, balance the blood sugar. Address mitochondrial dysfunction, and a lot of antioxidants are important there. Test homocysteine levels, get B vitamin support, adrenal and thyroid support. These are important, critical things that you've got to be working on regardless of the SNPs, right? And it's going to help to support a lot of those SNPs. The steps are, and this was taken directly from a Ben Lynch program, and I was like, I could have written, this is exactly what I like to do. You get them to get into their goals. You do a detailed health history. You look at their environment. You help them clean it up. You look at their lifestyle. You look at their diet, their gut, their blood sugar, their adrenals, their thyroid, their mitochondria, detoxification. You look to see if there's pathogens. You look at their cell membranes, neurotransmission, methylation, and finally the SNPs. Okay, so these are the things you need to do, and you know how to do these. What I've taught you in this presentation is helping you to be able to use what you find in the SNPs to help them to stay away from things, to help them to add things, to help them to shore up their process. So the steps, hydration, got to start there, clean antioxidant-rich whole food diet, healthy lifestyle, gut healing, adaptogens. I'm just saying this over and over again in different ways, guys, because it's so, so important. We just spent 2 hours going over all of these nutrients, 2.5 hours, B vitamins. Diet basics, you guys know this stuff. I teach this stuff all the time. You guys follow it. It's super important if you want to optimize your genetic potential. Okay? And then the holistic perspective is needed. We can't just look at one. You know, the story of the blind man and the elephant, every place when they looked at it at just a certain part or felt it at a certain part, it seemed like something different. When you put it together, that's what makes the big picture. The only one gene that we know about that is a specific cause and effect is cystic fibrosis. Everything else is all kinds of compensatory processes, and the things work together. They work apart. They antagonize each other. So it's understanding, but it all comes down to core of clean diet lifestyle and then compensate for the areas that you cannot detoxify by taking away the stress and compensate for areas where maybe your nutrient absorption may not be so good by adding those foods that contain those nutrients and then supplementing as needed. What's the action plan? I would say for you guys, you want to use this in your practice, get the 23andMe testing, do it on yourself first, download your raw data, and then generate some reports. You can generate, about $100 worth of reports, right? It's worth the investment. I've done them all, Genetic Genie, Methylation and Detox. Those are free. MTHFR supports about $35. Metabolic Healing and Stratagene are around $40. And then optional, I don't care for those two, but they're really cheap, like $5 each. Join the Stratagene Facebook group. Once you get the Stratagene test, the report, you can join that Facebook group, and there's a ton of great resources. Ben Lynch is out there, and a lot of great people are out there. And always study with someone who's a few steps ahead, right? I'm probably a few steps ahead of most of you guys. Other people are a few steps ahead of me, so I learn from them. I never stop learning. I'm always looking into this stuff and always trying to maximize what I can do to support these folks. And the power of epigenetics, I like this. There were these studies done at Albert Einstein Medical College. They studied people over 100 years old to see, do they have these extra special genes? And you know what? They already had most of the bad genes. But the bad genes were turned off in those people. So what do we want to study? We want to study what are they doing, right? The blue zones type of stuff. We want to look at what are they doing to maximize the epigenetic expression. Remember, the genes are 5%. The epigenetics are 95%. Don't take it as a death sentence or a negative thing if you've got crappy genes, all right? Know that you can use that to inspire you to stay away from the Oreos, as Martha said earlier, to stay away from those foods and those supplements or those foods and those environments that are not supporting you. And then you pass that enthusiasm and passion on to your clients. And, you want to motivate them. What fits your busy schedule better? Exercising an hour a day or being dead 24 hours a day, right? That's where we want to get them to. What's important to you? What are you willing to do to get it? Here's some resources for you, additional resources too. You've got these slides and there's all kinds of stuff you can do, but the best way to grow your practice is to discover the key to unlocking even the most difficult client cases. And when you understand how to get them on these great diets, when you understand how it all works, so you can look at biochemical pathways and understand it and go, oh, maybe this is what's happening there. Maybe I need to help them supplement that. That's when you're going to get the great results, right? So I just love teaching this stuff. I'm passionate about it. And for those of you in NEPT, we have 36 modules worth of amazing information that's constantly being updated, and it's going to continue to be updated as we go. So you basically, if you're not in NEPT and you want to get there, just go to neptapply.com and we'll share with you if it's even right for you and if you want to get into the community. So thank you guys so much for being here. I think we're out of time for questions, but I've been asking all along. I'm just going to look real quick to see. Okay, so people are just talking about them. Can we get a sample of the Stirling report? If you, there may be one, Lynette or Martha, Lynette, who asked that, Martha? Lynette, in the nutrigenomics module that we have in NEPT for you. So I believe that we've uploaded some and maybe even my own. Okay, I think, yeah. And just run it. Just, upload your file and pay the $35. Okay? All right, everybody. Thank you. I'm going to stop my share. And I'm going to make this bigger. And I'm going to open up. If anybody wants to come on, I'm going to unmute you guys. All right. If anybody has anything more, I can take us down for like 2 or 3 more minutes to answer any questions. Otherwise, I'm supposed to be going out to a Christmas party. Wow. Have you on. Was this helpful? Can somebody open up the line and tell me what you think? Was this good?
There's one question. There's one question that we have.
You're quiet. Did I mute you? I unmuted.
Can you hear me?
All participants are unmuted.
Can you hear me?
Huh. Still showing you muted. That's wild. No?
Can you hear me?
Allow attendees to chat with everybody. Save chat.
Can you hear me?
All right. You hear Lynn? You know what? I turned my volume down. That's what happened. Remember earlier? I turned it off because there was some beeping. Okay. Now can I hear everybody? Sorry.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right. There was a question that we asked earlier about damage from glyphosate to the DNA.
Yeah.
Good
question.
So
it's hard for me to read and teach at the same time.
Is this a permanent DNA
damage?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think more research would have to be done. I don't know how you determine.
Yeah, I've just read. All I've read is that there's this potential for damage that they keep talking about to the DNA and RNA and.
Okay. What's that?
Oh, I thought I heard somebody say something.
I heard somebody say something. I thought too. No. Yeah, I don't know enough about that to know whether it is. So it would be a good thing to look into. Yeah, you're a good researcher. You want to look into it and let us know.
Well, I posted a couple of studies on it because we were talking about it on the, it's either the INE or NEPT group. So I posted a couple of studies.
Okay.
And then we knew that you were going to be doing this tonight. So we thought we would ask here too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's probably, it might even be too soon to tell, you know, because.
That's kind of what they're saying. It's like, well, here's what we know so far.
So far. Exactly. And, you know, it's hard to know if something is going to be permanent, right? Because. You have to go through a process of, okay, what's the damage and how do we go about repairing it? And did that repair process work? Do you know what I mean?
Right.
It's not like I have a deficiency.
It really comes down to we shouldn't be using it.
We shouldn't be using it. I mean, we're killing ourselves with all that stuff, right? So we really do need to be as careful as possible and avoid GMO foods. Ban it. I mean, we're having trouble banning it because Monsanto has so much money and they keep knocking the legislation.
And they think we're nuts.
Yeah, but, you know, we're the only country that allows that. Like, Europe has banned it. So it's just Monsanto.
Well, some of them have.
Well, a bunch of them have, yeah.
Some of them are, right.
But it's a greed thing, right? And it's big business getting a hold of us and saying, you know, what we say goes. And they have the money to make it happen. And it's unfortunate.
Right.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for being here. Susan said thank you so much for the time you spent to put this together. This was a lot of work to put together, believe me. But it's definitely something that, it definitely needed to happen. So I needed to update. I have some older presentations that didn't have all this newest stuff in it. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you.